action speak aloud.
Listen to your heart,
what your heart might say.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
IBM, already embroiled in a slew of lawsuits over chemical exposure at its computer component manufacturing facilities, is now accused of pressuring a scientific journal into spiking a study showing increased rates of cancer among its workforce. The journal, Clinics in Occupational and Environmental Medicine, initially accepted a report which contained statistics showing a higher-than-normal rate of rare cancers among IBM workers, and especially those at manufacturing plants where various chemical solvents are used in production. Rates for brain cancer and some types of lymphoma, for example, were found to be double the national average for the general U.S. population. The journal, owned by the Dutch publishing conglomerate Reed Elsevier, denies IBM involvement in its decision, but an academic boycott of the publication is already well underway. Yesterday, IBM announced it settled 50 worker lawsuits alleging exposure to toxins at work caused their health problems.
Green Party members aren't apologizing for a Bush presidency and are meeting this week in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for their Forward 2004 convention. They're choosing a presidential nominee, and it may not be Ralph Nader who wins the endorsement this year. Longtime party activist David Cobb served as the general counsel for the Green Party of the United States until declaring his candidacy, and was the 2002 Green Party of Texas candidate for attorney general.
The HMOs and the pharmaceutical companies and all the rest of the corporations are making billions of dollars by treating health care as a commodity.
Party members vote for a nominee on Saturday. Also on the convention agenda is a Sunday anti-war pro-jobs march and adopting an official party platform.
The Norwegian oil industry is considering locking out its workforce in order to break a strike at several North Sea oil rigs. The strike began last Friday and stemmed from concerns the workers had about weakened pension proposals and a stalled drive to organize more staff on the offshore platforms. Currently, the strikes cut about 500,000 barrels of output per day. A lockout would effectively shut off the entire spigot, 3 million barrels per day. As Norway is the world's third largest oil exporter and draws nearly a quarter of its national income from oil, a lockout may force the government to step into the controversy.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Bush is the first president since Herbert Hoover to preside over a net loss of U.S. jobs. So why should Iraq be any different? A report released this week by the Education for Peace in Iraq Center urges the Bush administration to put increased resources into job creation. More than 2 million Iraqis are unemployed out of about 8 million. So far, the Coalition Provisional Authority has created about 400,000 jobs, 450,000 short of its stated goal.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where a victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
Martha Stewart has a plan. Of course she has a plan. The multi-million dollar maven of how to live the affluent lifestyle always has a plan. Whether it's a plan for gold-leafing walnut shells to use as individual caviar cups at your next dinner party, or a plan to dump her shares of M-Clone Inc. just before the price crashed, Martha is always ready. As she approaches the prospect of spending a bit of time in the federal pokey for her conviction in that insider stock dumping scheme, she already has a plan to lighten her jail term. She's proposed that she get good time credit, thus shortening her sentence, by helping underprivileged women. How? By cleaning their apartments? Sewing new clothes for their children? No, no, darling. By teaching poor women how to start their own businesses. One wonders, will her course include an ethics lecture? After her term, Martha might follow the path blazed by Walter Pavlow. A former top executive of MCI, he spent a year and a half in prison after being convicted of wire fraud and money laundering. With an outside partner, it seems that Walter had devised a convoluted accounting scheme so he could loot $6 million from MCI customers. Bad boy. But being bad, at least for white-collar criminals, can put you in demand on the corporate lecture circuit. Ex-con Walter, for example, was recently the featured speaker at UC Berkeley's Center for Responsible Business. Walter pulls down $5,000 a speech and expects to take in up to $200,000 this year, telling audiences just how bad he was. There's even a speakers bureau called Pros and Cons that specializes in marketing such corporate crime confessors as Walter. I'm sure they'd welcome Martha. This is Jim Hightower saying, the lesson here is clear. If you're going to be a criminal, be a white-collar one. The after-prison gigs are a lot better.
As a small business owner, you turn multitasking into a fine art. Because for you, doing several things all at the same time is just another day at the office. So who better than you to appreciate how Sam's Club offers the option of doing two things at once. Buying items you need for your business, while at the same time buying items you need for your home. In addition to finding what you need for your business, you'll find name brand electronics, sporting goods, and fine jewelry, as well as many of the everyday essentials every home needs. When you shop at Sam's Club, you get the same everyday low costs on items for your home as you do on items for your business. And when you're really pressed for time, try using Click and Pull and Fax and Pull, convenient services to help you order ahead for fast pickup. Place your order at samsclub.com or by fax before 5 p.m. and at no extra charge, it's ready to pick up the next morning. You've got a lot going on. Count on us to help you get it done. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border. On radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite, streaming around the planet on a PeerCast program off WhiteRoseSociety.org and on cable radio network, and even appearing on people's TVs on CRN. What a fascinating world we live in. Anyway, welcome to the program. Just a quick thing about the news. We will get back to this in more detail later. The U.S. Supreme Court just said, yes, Dick Cheney can keep secret from you and me who met at his Energy Department meetings. We'll give you a more thorough rant on that after a few things here I want to take care of. But first, I want to get into this issue of what has happened. Actually, it's very relevant to this. It's very germane to this. Because, you know, what has happened with Halliburton and the United States government, not just Halliburton, I mean just the whole thing. Halliburton is emblematic of it. And I want to start by just reminding you, as Dwight Eisenhower, I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan's been in the news a lot lately. You know, last night Ron Reagan was on Larry King saying, I don't know why George Bush feels like he has to wrap himself in the mantle of my father. Can't he stand on his own 2 feet? Stuff like that. Anyhow, as Dwight Eisenhower, a classic conservative, a true conservative president, was leaving office, He made an observation and issued a warning. And the observation was that the Cold War, the nuclear competition with the Soviet Union, was producing something unique in American history. So unique that even the recent Korean War and World War II hadn't produced this. This was a brand new thing as of that time, about 180 years of American history. And so here first is his observation, and it's a really brilliant one. This was his farewell speech as he was leaving office. Jack Kennedy was coming into office the next day. Here's Dwight Eisenhower.
Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry.
See, I mean, that's fascinating. Who can even imagine? No armaments industry. None. Until the last two years or so of the Eisenhower administration.
American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well.
Yeah, like General Motors made tanks, you know, for World War II, for example.
But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment.
And this is no small matter,
he says. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations.
And it's still
now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society.
And then Eisenhower issued solemnly this warning.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
That was, by the way, the first time that phrase had ever been used in history, the military-industrial complex. He continued,
the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Endanger our liberties or democratic processes. Well, a fellow by the name of Dan Briody. Dan, am I pronouncing that right?
It's actually pronounced Briody.
Briody. Thank you very much. I'm sorry. I should have checked with you when I had you on the phone here before. Anyhow, Dan Briody has written a book. He's the author of the bestseller, The Iron Triangle, and he has a new book out called The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money. And Dan has this dark vision, this warning to America, and it was unambiguously a warning by Dwight Eisenhower, come to pass.
Well, I think it definitely has. Maybe not in the same way that Eisenhower perceived it at the time. I think that he felt that it would be more of a nuclear type of military-industrial complex.
Well, and it certainly was for a while.
It was for a while, but thankfully we're starting to move away from that into a much more subtle and fascinating form of military-industrial complex in which the military is outsourcing tremendous amounts of its obligations and services to private contractors, and they are becoming essentially new branches of the military which have acquired a tremendous amount of power and influence.
And are not accountable to we the people because they're private corporations. They are shielded by corporate personhood laws that give them privacy protections that don't apply to the government when the government used to do those exact same functions in many cases.
That's right. A lot of people believe that one of the core tenets of a government, one of the core things that a government should do is defense. It should be protect the people. In fact, that's where our tax dollars should be going. As it turns out, most of those tax dollars are not going to straight to the military. They are instead going through the military into the hands of private contractors.
Of the $447 billion that was just, I believe, just yesterday passed as the appropriation for next year's defense budget. Well, you know, typically last year was a little over $400 billion. What percentage of that is actually ending up in private corporate hands?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, there haven't been any studies done on outsourcing of the military. Unfortunately, you know, everyone sort of jumped on the bandwagon in the late 80s and early 90s thinking that, you know, free market competition, privatization, it's got to be good for business, we'll achieve efficiencies and save a lot of money and maybe pump up our economy while we're at it. As it turns out, though, we have not seen any studies conducted that have determined whether it is actually saving us money. And a lot of the reports that we're getting back from the front lines, from Iraq, are indicating the exact opposite, that we are being overcharged and gouged as taxpayers.
Well, you know, given the fact we're talking with Dan Briety?
Yes, Briety.
Dan Briety, author of The Halliburton Agenda. Given the fact that the first mandate of a government agency like the Defense Department is to defend the United States, and all decisions have to be made in the context of, are we doing the best job to defend the United States? Whereas the first mandate of a for-profit corporation, Halliburton, for example, but any for-profit corporation, has to be, are we making a profit and serving the interests of our shareholders? And then secondly, are we, providing meals to GIs or whatever? I mean, given the fact that the first mandate of a for-profit corporation has to be to make profit, and that has to come from somewhere, even if a for-profit corporation operates on a more efficient basis than government, which is hard to imagine with, you know, multi-million-dollar CEO salaries and private jets that have gold fixtures in the bathrooms and huge, expensive, lavish corporate headquarters. And, you know, the report that the drug companies now spend twice as much on marketing. They spend twice as much advertising the fact that they do research and development than they do on research and development. Which is nothing new. I mean, American Express used to spend twice as much promoting the fact that you could get refunds on traveler's checks than they spent on refunds on traveler's checks, but they weren't providing health care to us. I mean, it's a big difference. Should we be surprised by this? I mean, this is really the conservative agenda. Let's turn American government over to private corporations, and let's let private corporations make decisions for America. I mean, isn't this
true? And there are, you know, the benefits of that, or at least the proposed benefits of it, are that we create more efficient markets and save money. But, you know, your point is well taken, that these folks do not answer to the American taxpayer. They answer to their shareholders. They answer to their bottom line. So it is a different set of priorities for private contractors than the government has. And that creates what we're seeing today in Iraq with Halliburton and other contractors over there who are operating on a cost-plus contract basis, which literally encourages the contractor to spend more because they are reimbursed for all of their costs while they're over there, plus a percentage of those costs is built in as their profit.
Right.
And that ends up actually giving them incentive to spend more money, and that's why we've seen some of these outrageous charges since Halliburton has been operating in Iraq.
Yeah, and we've seen some estimates that as much as $1 billion, you know, in the last year has been just basically ripped off from you and me, which is, you know, not a small amount of money. Now, talking with Dan Briety, Briety. Okay, I got it. It's an I.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Dan.
That's okay.
Here we go. Dan Briety, B-R-I-O-D-Y, author of The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money. In your book, you talk about Halliburton's doing business with Iran, Libya, Iraq, back when Saddam was considered a bad guy.
I mean, and while Dick Cheney was CEO as well. Yeah, between 1995 and 2000, Dick Cheney, CEO and chairman of Halliburton Company, three or four years after he had led the first Gulf War campaign as Secretary of Defense, is doing $73 million worth of business with Saddam Hussein.
Now, this is the guy who's going on network television, who went on network television last weekend and said, yes, there were contacts between al-Qaeda and Saddam. And we know that those contacts were, you know, number one, not fruitful, and number two, you know, four or five times somebody from al-Qaeda said to Saddam, hey, you want to talk? And Saddam said, hey, go away.
Right.
Doing so, $73 million.
He hasn't been that concerned with those contacts between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda while he was CEO of Halliburton.
It's just, right.
It just goes to show you, you know, that there are some real politics of convenience being played here.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's talking about the contacts between Halliburton and Saddam. I mean, millions of dollars worth of business being done. That's more than just, you know, a few meetings where Saddam says, go take a hike, isn't it?
No, this was real business, and it was done through a program called Oil for Food, which was run by the UN, which is now under investigation for extreme corruption. And it just goes to show you that Dick Cheney talks out of both sides of his mouth.
Yeah, we're talking with Dan Brady, the author of The Halliburton Agenda. We'll be right back. This is the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Tom Hartmann here with you 20 minutes past the hour. Stay tuned.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is a small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com. Or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartmann Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartmann, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartmann helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
The war they are in has been declared over by the same man who lied them into it. Their reward? Combat pay cut in half. $1.5 billion cut to their family housing. $20 billion cut to military health care. No health care for reservists.
Lancers, bring them on.
Thousands wounded, hundreds dead, and no end in sight. If we support our troops, why can't Bush? Or is this what they mean when they say an army of one?
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartmann. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Now, come and get some information here. Tom Hartman with you, 25 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Dan Briety, who's the author of The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money, available in bookstores, presumably all across the country, Dan?
Yep.
Okay. Is there a website for your book or for your work?
Yeah, you could go to Amazon or barnesandnoble.com, or you can go to danbriety.com.
danbriody.com. Correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, great. You in your book, you talk about the Halliburton's practice, alleged practice, of overcharging the U.S. government for gas in Iraq and overstaffing government-funded projects in Bosnia and Somalia. This is nothing new with Halliburton?
It's important to remember that this is a company that has been doing this literally for 80 years now. They're just celebrating their 80-year anniversary.
Yeah, they started out to... go ahead.
World War II, Vietnam, Bosnia, Somalia, they have been involved in the military-industrial complex in all of those wars. They have been accused of overcharging in all of those wars. And really what they receive is a slap on the wrist, and they continue doing business. It turns out that, you know, whatever penalties that they have to pay, whether they have to, you know, pay the government back $61 million for overcharges on gas, it's all part of the cost of doing business for these guys. They factor it into their business.
Yeah, and yet if you or I were caught embezzling $61 million from our local bank, what would happen to us?
We'd be in jail.
Yeah, for a long time. And this is just mind-boggling. Now, your previous book, if you don't mind just delving into this, The Iron Triangle, Inside the Secret World of the Carlyle Group, which is published by Wiley last year, and I assume is still available in stores?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I noticed yesterday, in fact, we reported on this program, that the Carlyle Group has just participated in the buyout of one of, I believe it was Odeon Cineplex. I don't have the story right in front of me, but one of America's largest theater chains.
Right, Lowe's Cineplex, yeah.
Lowe's Cineplex. Okay, thanks. And what's up with that? I mean, you know, does the Carlyle Group, you know, for example, Michael Moore's movie now is you know, struggling to get on screens. They had originally hoped for 1,000. According to Variety, they're pushing 800. According to some reports, it's 500. Is this just a good investment? I mean, no, is this just Jimmy Buffett or Warren Buffett rather's gig, or does the Carlyle Group seek to impose their agenda on the companies
in
which they invest?
Well, I certainly think that with the Carlyle Group in ownership of Lowe's Cineplex, Michael Moore's movie is not going to be pointed on too many Lowe's screens, because the movie is very critical of the Carlyle Group. And with that kind of control, certainly they would be able to wield some sense of censorship, I would think. However, the thing you have to remember about the Carlyle Group, and the same thing with Halliburton too, these companies are about money. They are about nothing. They're not about, you know, political agendas or foreign policy. They want to make gobs and gobs of money.
And they're not about democracy. Yeah, and they're...
Wait. Go ahead, Tom.
And they're not about democracy. That's the bizarre part of the conservative agenda, is let's hand, you know, starting going back to Ayn Rand's, you know, Atlas Shrugged, which is kind of the philosophical beacon for so many of these guys, let's hand it over to the corporations. They'll do it more efficiently, and somehow people forget it. It's got nothing to do with democracy. In fact, it harms democracy. Dan, we've got about a minute left. I'll let you wrap it up.
Well, I just want to say one thing, and that is that, you know, I think that quite often when I speak to people overseas and interview people for these books, I ask them about, you know, companies like the Carlyle Group, like Halliburton. What do they see in these companies? And what they so often tell me is that they don't distinguish between democracy and capitalism. Right. They think that America stands for both. They, in fact, some people even think that our form of government here in the United States is capitalism. That's actually what our government is. So, obviously, the lines have gotten crossed somewhere along the way, and we need to untangle them.
We definitely do. Dan Briody, thank you very much for being with us. www.danbriody.com, his website, the new book, The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour. Stay tuned. We'll be back. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
IBM already embroiled in a slew of lawsuits over chemical exposure at its computer component manufacturing facilities is now accused of pressuring a scientific journal into spiking a study showing increased rates of cancer among its workforce. The journal, Clinics in Occupational and Environmental Medicine, initially accepted a report which contained statistics showing a higher than normal rate of rare cancers among IBM workers, and especially those at manufacturing plants where various chemical solvents are used in production. Rates for brain cancer and some types of lymphoma, for example, were found to be double the national average for the general U.S. population. The journal, owned by the Dutch publishing conglomerate Reed Elsevier, denies IBM involvement in its decision, but an academic boycott of the publication is already well underway. Yesterday, IBM announced it settled 50 worker lawsuits alleging exposure to toxins at work caused their health problems.
Green Party members aren't apologizing for a Bush presidency and are meeting this week in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for their Forward 2004 convention. They're choosing a presidential nominee, and it may not be Ralph Nader who wins the endorsement this year. Longtime party activist David Cobb served as the general counsel for the Green Party of the United States until declaring his candidacy and was the 2002 Green Party of Texas candidate for attorney general.
The HMOs and the pharmaceutical companies and all the rest of the corporations are making billions of dollars by treating health care as a commodity.
Party members vote for a nominee on Saturday. Also on the convention agenda is a Sunday anti-war pro-jobs march and adopting an official party platform.
The Norwegian oil industry is considering locking out its workforce in order to break a strike at several North Sea oil rigs. The strike began last Friday and stemmed from concerns the workers had about weakened pension proposals and a stalled drive to organize more staff on the offshore platforms. Currently, the strikes cut about 500,000 barrels of output per day. A lockout would effectively shut off the entire spigot, 3 million barrels per day. As Norway is the world's third largest oil exporter and draws nearly a quarter of its national income from oil, a lockout may force the government to step into the controversy.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Bush is the first president since Herbert Hoover to preside over a net loss of U.S. jobs. So why should Iraq be any different? A report released this week by the Education for Peace in Iraq Center urges the Bush administration to put increased resources into job creation. More than 2 million Iraqis are unemployed out of about 8 million. So far, the Coalition Provisional Authority has created about 400,000 jobs, 450,000 short of its stated goal.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
conservatives. It's the Tom Hartman radio program defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Speaking of conservatives, I opened the show with this quote from Eisenhower from his farewell address, and he was so eloquent, this guy. I have somewhere in my archives a clip. I'm not going to go find it right now and play it for you, but longtime listeners have heard it before, of the Eisenhower campaign commercials from the 1950s, where it was, vote for peace, vote for Ike. And he ran as a peace candidate. He ran as the peace candidate. He was the guy who was going to, resolve the Korean conflict and bring peace to the world and the United States. And in his farewell, and keep in mind, this is how conservatives used to be, or this is how Republicans used to be, let's say, before the radical, extremist, corporatist, fascistic right-wingers, like you hear on talk radio, And you see in the form of people like Tom DeLay and Bill Frist and George W. Bush took over so much of our media and most of our government. Here, you just have to hear the words of Dwight Eisenhower to understand, you know, what those of us who are old enough to remember, and I barely remember Eisenhower. I mean, you know, I was, when this speech was given, I was what, 11 years old, 10 years old, something like that. But I remember him. And those of us who are old enough to remember what America was like then, this again from Eisenhower's farewell speech. You just have to hear this. This guy was brilliant. He spoke to the best in us, and he really believed it.
As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today.
See, he was speaking in that context of government spending borrowing huge quantities of money to spend, to give tax cuts to people, and you know the impulse of living for today and mortgaging our children's future. Well, I'll let Eisenhower say it. He says it better than me.
Plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage.
Yeah.
We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
And as Dan pointed out, the modern con agenda is not about democracy surviving, as Eisenhower believed in. It's about corporatism surviving. It's about 3,000 or 4,000, 2,000 or 3,000, really a very small handful of very large corporations, perhaps as few as a few hundred, running the world. Certainly running the United States, but ultimately running the world through what's called the World Trade Association, the World Trade Organization, the WTO. And funny, you think it sounds like conspiracy theory, look around you. Anyhow, here's Eisenhower again.
During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect.
Can you, just compare that with the guy who's in the White House now. I mean, it's so tragic.
Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose.
And then he goes on to talk about his prayer for America's future.
May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power.
And this, by the way, was not in the form of, you know, trying to reach out to his conservative right-wing religious Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, let's pander and suck up to them base. This was not what Eisenhower was about.
Diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. to all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth, and that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love.
Dwight D. Eisenhower, President of the United States, in his farewell address in either late December or early January of 1960 or early 1961, just before he turned over the presidency to John F. Kennedy. I listen to Eisenhower and many of his other speeches, and I mourn, I truly mourn for what America could have, well, for what has happened to the Republican Party, really, frankly. I mean, back then when he was giving that speech, I was, you know, my dad's a Republican, always has been, probably always will be, still is. And I was into it at the time, 10 years old, you know. And it's not the same party. I'm sorry. It's not the same party. It's been taken over by madmen. It's been taken over by extremists. These are not conservatives. They are extremists. They are radicals. And now, you know, at the end of the month, we're going to be giving up. We're going to be giving up the ability to control Iraq's cash from the sale of their oil. I don't know if you realize, but once we invaded Iraq, we took over from the United Nations the money, the control of the money from the sale of the oil, which was going to the oil for food program, you know, to feed people. I mean, that was the theory. And we took that over and started the Coalition Provisional Authority started passing it out. Andrew Cockburn has written a great op-ed piece, first appeared in the L.A. Times. It was in our paper here today in Vermont. He says, in these final days, the U.S.-dominated Coalition Provisional Authority has gone on a shopping spree, gaily spending the hoard of Iraqi cash it controls. The CPA, he says, there appears to be an end-of-school atmosphere that has taken hold of the Coalition Provisional Authority, his folks in there. This is most vividly expressed at a meeting last month at which it was decided to hand out almost $2 billion in Iraqi assets. Not American dollars, but Iraqi money over which the U.S. authorities had assumed responsibility to a host of, quote, deserving, end quote, causes. In November, for example, Congress, with Halliburton in mind, banned the use of taxpayers' money for any more large non-competitive contracts. So the CPA simply dipped into the Iraqi money for Halliburton. Those happy days, Andrew Cockburn notes, are due to come to an end Wednesday, which may be why the Program Review Board at its May 15th meeting cheerfully agreed to dole out $2 billion of the $10 billion remaining in the fund to what Iraqi Revenue Watch describes as, quote, hastily conceived programs. And he goes through and describes some of them. And there, I mean, this is just, you know, pork barrel pie. You know, let's hand out money to big corporations that donate lots of money to the re-election campaign of George W. Bush. That's what it boils down to. As one Iraqi official remarked dolefully, Cockburn reports, quote, Paul Bremer could order 20 jumbo jets and Boeing with our money anytime before June 30th, and there's nothing we could do about it. And apparently, I mean, you know, he hasn't cut a deal with Boeing, but with just about everybody else. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to comment on the thoughts of the day. Chuck in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chuck, welcome.
Hey there, Tom. You know, you really made me nostalgic remembering the ethics and the brilliance and the subtlety of the Eisenhower presidency. I guess we're about the same age. I'm coming up on 53. And fundamentally, I think when we get right down to it, one of the things that Eisenhower talked about was the military-industrial complex. And here's a five-star general that, dealt with the Nazis and, basically was in charge of the D-Day operation, turning right around and saying, look, we have to be careful about this. This is something that is maybe during an intense time of war against Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan is important, but, it's not what it should be in terms of a general day-to-day interaction between the government and these companies.
Well, he understood. Eisenhower understood, and I think most Americans at that time understood that there's this thing called democracy, which is not an economic system, it's a political system. And in the context of the political system of democracy, which is government of, by, and for we the people, within the constraints of the Constitution, that we protect minorities, but we fulfill the will of the majority to the extent that it doesn't infringe on the rights of minorities, that within the context of that political system, we have numerous, actually, financial systems, and the one that is probably the largest and most powerful in America is capitalism, where you invest capital and you get a return on your investment. And a true capitalist is somebody who simply makes investments and gets money back from those investments. And then you have a smaller version of that, which is broadly called free enterprise, which is what most small businesses are all about, entrepreneurs are all about, where most of the capital that they're investing is sweat equity. Most small businesses, the person who starts the business doesn't even take a salary for the first year or two. They're working on part time creating their business, or they're borrowing money from other people, or from their friends and family, or their savings, or whatever, and they build this thing up. And so there's these multiple types of economies within that are allowed for within democracy. And the cons that have taken over the Republican Party have said no. What really is important here is the power of corporations, because they're more efficient than government. Anything government does is bad. We saw that in the Soviet Union, and anything that corporations do is good, and that's really the thinking, and it comes out of this twisted worldview that Ayn Rand had, having grown up in the Soviet Union, having watched her father lose his business in the Bolshevik Revolution, having studied political science in the USSR at the University of Kiev, and then coming to the United States and writing Atlas Shrugged, this novel where you've got these noble capitalists who are thwarted at every turn by these insane, weird government bureaucrats.
Well, Tom, I think it's interesting. I think that you just hit it right on the head. I think any extremist view is problematic. I think that somewhere in the middle is where balance is found. And I appreciate, your show, because that's where I feel like balance can be found.
Yeah, well, that's, I call the program Uncommon Sense in the Radical Middle, and it's weird because, everybody says this is liberal talk radio, and sure, I'll acknowledge that, but I really think that the things that I'm saying are the things that really most Americans, deep down inside, believe and hope, and that's what, this is the country that they want. This is the country we once had.
Well, we did have it, and we had, it's very interesting. I had a professor in college that said, you should look at the painting on the back of a $2 bill and say, this is probably the greatest collection of intellect ever painted picture in the history of the world. These people, unfortunately all men, but although I think highly influenced by the women in their lives, they created something that no one, including Alex de Tocqueville, believed was possible, and it worked.
And this is why proportional representation is so widespread, is because most of the democracies in the world came about after the Civil War. Because during the Civil War, everybody in Europe, they were all very skeptical for the first three generations after America was founded. As de Tocqueville's, the second half of his book, Democracy in America, basically was an argument about how it couldn't work. Aristocracy is the only stable form of government, as George W. Bush will tell you, and de Tocqueville said, and then the whole world held its breath during the Civil War, and they said, see, You know, the experiment is about to fail. And Lincoln pulled it off, and he pulled the nation back together, and the other countries said, hey, you know, maybe this democracy thing is something we should try.
One last comment's very interesting. I was actually living in Europe when Switzerland finally became what I would think is a democracy. They gave women the right to vote somewhere around 1972. But, you know, you would have all these people that would come together in guest houses and whatnot, and they would watch debates on television in Switzerland, and then they would all vote. And, you know, admittedly, it's the Canton system and much smaller, but you know what? This can work.
Yeah.
It can.
Yeah.
We proved it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Democracy can work. Thanks a lot for the call, Chuck. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Alex in Florida's on the line, 1-866.
Yeah,
go ahead, Alex.
Yeah. Okay, you're talking about the Eisenhower administration. Do you remember the McCarthy hearings?
Yeah.
You do, and you think that was great?
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that there were not extremists during the Eisenhower administration. We had segregation during the Eisenhower administration. You know, there were a lot of flaws and a lot of faults. But the reality is that people who lived through people who lived through the administration of Roosevelt and Truman, which is when we came back from 50 years of you know, the Gilded Age of conservative rule, basically, where there was no middle class, that people who were living in the middle class that came about as a result of Roosevelt's efforts got it. They understood democracy. And I think the majority of people today don't. I just think they don't. Alex, thanks for the call. I appreciate your pointing that out. There have been flaws in all administrations. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Do you want to own a computer? Is your credit less than perfect? If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, then you are already approved for a brand new IBM, Dell, eMachine, or other name brand computer guaranteed. You heard right. Bad credit? No credit? No problem. There is no credit check, so you will not be turned down. If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, you are approved for your brand new name brand computer. Just call 800-588-0596. Freedom Frog Funding says you are approved. So give us a call today at 800-588-0596 to have your brand new computer shipped right to you. And if you act now, we'll add a $200 upgrade and a one-year warranty for free. You heard right. We will upgrade your computer and throw in a warranty absolutely free. So don't wait. Let Freedom Frog Funding send you the computer of your dreams today. Call 800-588-0596. That number is 800-588-0596.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me this October as we explore Greece, the ancient birthplace of democracy. When the Founding Fathers were searching for the best and fairest form of government, they studied the models of Athenian democracy. We'll explore together this part of the ancient world where the ideas that today animate modern democracy were first worked out. This journey is set on the shore of the sparkling Mediterranean Sea with the sacred mountains of Crete behind us. We'll visit the ancient site of Gortian, famous for the Law Code of Gortian, large 6th century BC tablets of stone built into a wall and one of the first examples of laws ever written down and now the oldest still in existence. I'll teach workshops at the two most important sites in all of Crete, Knossos and Phaistos, plus more. At Knossos, we'll experience the main ceremonial center and the palace of King Minos. For information on how you can join us on this trip of a lifetime, visit www.tomhartman.com or call 1-800-234-TOUR. That's 1-800-234-TOUR, T-O-U-R.
Tom Hartman will be joining the exceptional faculty of The Great Rethinking, The Prophets Oxford, taking place the weekend of September 10th through 12th at Oxford University, England. You are invited to join Tom Hartman in Oxford, along with other leading visionaries, including Vandana Shiva, Helen Caldicott, and Rupert Sheldrake, among others, to rethink and reshape our collective future. The Great Rethinking Oxford premise is that this tumultuous time in our human history may be crafted into the birthing of something truly new. And you can play your part in shaping this new worldview by joining Tom Hartman September 10th through 12th. To find out how, go to the website greatmystery.org. That's greatmystery.org. Together, we will make a difference.
A biologist says New York could and should become famous for its fish farms. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. People in New York City eat a lot of fish. The appetites of nearly 30 million people in and around the city create the largest seafood market in the United States. Martin P. Schreibman says it makes sense for these people to raise their own fish instead of shipping it in. Schreibman is a biologist at Brooklyn College in the City University of New York. He helped develop a kind of fish farming that uses less space than traditional methods. He says that makes it possible to raise fish anywhere you can put a big tank of water with plumbing and filters, even in New York City itself. The technology is called recirculating aquaculture. The system purifies water over and over so it can be reused, and it can be set up indoors. Schreibman says that has definite advantages.
Bringing it indoors, it obviates dealing with climatic changes, insects, whatever pollutants might be in the air or in the water. So it's very friendly to the environment as well as enabling growth in a closed area.
Schreibman says raising fish across New York State would cut the cost of importing millions of pounds of fish into the state each year. And he says the fish to put in those fish farms is tilapia.
It seems to be the rage, and tilapia is fifth or sixth in sales nationwide, and the popularity is caught on. They are hardy fish. They're relatively easy to grow. They're fast growers. You know, they're ready for market in six and a half months, and they taste good.
Schreibman sees the potential for a fish farming frenzy across New York. In fact, he can see the day when the state is as famous for tilapia as Maine is for lobster and Oregon is for salmon. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 4 minutes before the hour. Time for our conservative alert of the day. Yes, indeed, this is from conservativealerts.com.
According to CNSNews.com, Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa, announced last week that he has successfully amended the fiscal year 2005 defense authorization bill, adding a censorship provision that calls on American Forces Radio and Television Service to, quote, provide political balance in its public affairs programming. In other words, to remove the highly popular Limbaugh from our troops' airwaves. What it was his reasoning. Harkin was quoted as saying that American Forces Radio and Television Service is funded by taxpayers of all political persuasions, and therefore it should, quote, make a greater effort to provide balanced representation of political viewpoints on its airwaves to American service members around the world, end quote. What? This is followed by three question marks and three exclamation marks. What? We need to take action now, in all caps, to stop this censorship of traditional American values, conservative values on the troops' airwaves. If they succeed here, their next step will be to reintroduce the Fairness Doctrine and get Limbaugh and all conservative talk radio off the air. Take action. What makes this worse is that Harkin's amendment passed in the Senate by unanimous consent. Not one Republican senator stepped forward to defend Rush. Not one! Please go to our website below and tell your congressmen and senators to stop the attempt to censor Rush Limbaugh on Armed Forces Radio. Our conservative alert for the day.
Yes. You know, I really don't think that Harkin is trying to censor Limbaugh. I think he's saying, okay, if you're going to have a right-winger on Armed Forces Radio, why don't you have a left winger on too? You know, put on somebody else who could balance him. I would offer myself as a candidate, although there are numerous other good programs out there. But you know, or just take it off and do news. I mean, you know, it's after all, it's taxpayer funded. All of us are paying for it. It really should represent all of us. Pharmaceutical industry spends this a
you know, new news release today. The pharmaceutical industry spends twice as much on PR and marketing than it does on drug research and development. $13.2 billion on marketing last year. Amazing. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman Program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
IBM already embroiled in a slew of lawsuits over chemical exposure at its computer component manufacturing facilities is now accused of pressuring a scientific journal into spiking a study showing increased rates of cancer among its workforce. The journal, Clinics in Occupational and Environmental Medicine, initially accepted a report which contained statistics showing a higher than normal rate of rare cancers among IBM workers, and especially those at manufacturing plants where various chemical solvents are used in production. Rates for brain cancer and some types of lymphoma, for example, were found to be double the national average for the general U.S. population. The journal, owned by the Dutch publishing conglomerate Reed Elsevier, denies IBM involvement in its decision, but an academic boycott of the publication is already well underway. Yesterday, IBM announced it settled 50 worker lawsuits alleging exposure to toxins at work caused their health problems.
Green Party members aren't apologizing for a Bush presidency and are meeting this week in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for their Forward 2004 convention. They're choosing a presidential nominee, and it may not be Ralph Nader who wins the endorsement this year. Longtime party activist David Cobb served as the general counsel for the Green Party of the United States until declaring his candidacy and was the 2002 Green Party of Texas candidate for attorney general.
The HMOs and the pharmaceutical companies and all the rest of the corporations are making billions of dollars by treating health care as a commodity.
Party members vote for a nominee on Saturday. Also on the convention agenda is a Sunday anti-war pro-jobs march and adopting an official party platform.
The Norwegian oil industry is considering locking out its workforce in order to break a strike at several North Sea oil rigs. The strike began last Friday and stemmed from concerns the workers had about weakened pension proposals and a stalled drive to organize more staff on the offshore platforms. Currently, the strikes cut about 500,000 barrels of output per day. A lockout would effectively shut off the entire spigot, 3 million barrels per day. As Norway is the world's third largest oil exporter and draws nearly a quarter of its national income from oil, a lockout may force the government to step into the controversy.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Bush is the first president since Herbert Hoover to preside over a net loss of U.S. jobs. So why should Iraq be any different? A report released this week by the Education for Peace in Iraq Center urges the Bush administration to put increased resources into job creation. More than 2 million Iraqis are unemployed out of about 8 million. So far, the Coalition Provisional Authority has created about 400,000 jobs, 450,000 short of its stated goal.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
Does George W. get up every morning and gargle with a big glass of political cynicism? Or is he genetically cynical and just can't help himself? Take his recent radio address on Memorial Day weekend. Bush wrapped himself as tightly as possible in the flag and blathered on at length about how much he loves those veterans who have gone to war and fought for our freedom, a noble stand that he personally avoided taking when his time came, using family connections to keep him safely out of harm's way. But that's another story. In his address, George told the nation that we can acknowledge the debt we owe these veterans by, quote, showing our respect and gratitude. I don't know if he gargled before delivering this radio sermon, but I do know that just hours before it, Bush's budget office announced that it would cut $1 billion out of existing veterans' health care programs next year if Bush gets elected this fall. There's gratitude for you. These programs have already been so shortchanged by Bush that his own Secretary of Veterans Affairs has criticized their inadequacy. At present, nearly 350,000 injured and ill vets are having to wait in line to get admitted for health care because the VA system is so backed up. The average wait is more than 6 months. Yet rather than cutting the backlog, as Bush promised to do when he took office, he now proposes to cut 540 VA staffers who review disability claims to speed up the line and help veterans get the care they need. This $1 billion cut comes on top of Bush's ongoing attempt to close veterans' hospitals all across the country, his $50 million cut in medical research on new prosthetic technologies for dismembered vets, and his cutting off of 164,000 veterans from their existing prescription drug coverage. This is Jim Hightower saying, veterans could use a little less rhetorical respect from the president and a whole lot more tangible support.
America is a country of entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner, you're helping shoulder the lion's share of the U.S. economy. You can lighten that load a little by joining Sam's Club. Sam Walton created Sam's Club to give small business owners the purchasing power of big businesses. So no matter what kind of business you own, when you shop at Sam's Club, you get everyday low costs on products you need every day. And you can rely on us to carry those products at low warehouse prices. To save you time, we offer click and pull and fax and pull, convenient services to help you order ahead for fast pickup. Place your order at samsclub.com or by fax before 5 p.m. and at no extra charge, it's ready to pick up the next morning. Now that's teamwork. And we'd like to be a small part of your team. After all, while you may be carrying around the weight of the American economy, you shouldn't have to do all the heavy lifting by yourself. Join the club, Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, and streaming around the planet on CRN.com. Many get-tough approaches to crime do not work, says the American Bar Association. This is really an extraordinary bit of news. About a year ago, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was a conservative Republican appointed by Ronald Reagan, gave a speech to the ABA in which he said that minimum mandatory sentencing and three strikes you're out laws were creating a disaster in the United States, that they were essentially a bad thing in his opinion, and he suggested that the ABA look into it and spearhead an effort to do something about it. And they just came back with a report. I mean, this just came out.
The political phrase, tough on crime, should not lead us into moral blindness, is what Kennedy had said. And here's the first sentence of the story from the Associated Press. Many get-tough approaches to crime do not work, and some, such as mandatory minimum sentences for small-time drug offenders, are unfair and should be abolished, a report from the American Bar Association said yesterday. And so given that little bit of news, I mean, this is today's news, I'm really pleased to have on for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, right? It's the second hour of our Thursday program, and you know, we push the boundaries here of conventional wisdom, as it were, and challenge, you know, the widely held notions that people have, or have on guests that will challenge our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe. Could it be that everything all these legislators know is wrong? These minimum mandatory sentences certainly seem to be popular. Candidates love to run on them. We have Judge Jim Gray on the line. Judge Jim Gray has served in many positions. He was a federal prosecutor with the United States Attorney's Office in Los Angeles. He spent 5 years in private practice. He was a municipal court judge. And since 1989, he's been a superior court judge in California. Won the 92 Judge of the Year Award from the Orange County Bar Association, the 95 Judge of the Year Award from the Orange County Constitutional Rights Foundation. And he's the author of a book called Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, A Judicial Indictment of the War on Drugs. Judge Jim Gray, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom, thank you. It's certainly nice to be back with you.
What are your thoughts, first of all, on this ABA thing here today?
I saw that in our local papers as well, Tom, and I think it's absolutely correct and right on the money. Today in California, and that's pretty much the only place I can speak for, we have three times the number of people serving a 25 years to life sentence for a third strike for marijuana violations than we do robbery, rape, and murder combined.
You're kidding.
Talk about a moral blindness.
Then robbery, rape, and murder.
Very expensive.
Combined. That's
right. Combined. And the voters here, of course, the intent was to take violent people off the streets. And you and I agree with that. The problem is, of course, if you have this as a tool of the prosecutors here, they use it. And we have people that are shoplifting and people that are possessing drugs and writing bad checks and that sort of thing, all of which is something you have to be held accountable for. But it's just mindless and, of course, very expensive to the taxpayers.
Yeah, I mean, not to mention the fact that our prisons, increasingly as they're being handed over to private corporations to be run, are less places to help people learn to the error of their ways and return to society in a functional fashion, and more they've become, you know, kind of criminal universities.
That's right. We call them Department of Corrections, and that is not the case. It's part Department of Warehousing. And, you know, in California, in northern San Diego County, Tom, we have a really good but small drug treatment program there for drug-addicted people. And if you get involved in that with anger management classes and drug and health and high school education, plus an aftercare after they're released, they have found that the recidivism rate, that means the committing offenses rate within a year, has been reduced to 18%. For those same people that have not go through this program in aftercare, the recidivism rate is 80%. So why don't we spend our money on things that will help people? But unfortunately, in California, now they're reducing that drug treatment program because we don't have the money. So what we're doing is just downright stupid.
So you reduce the program because you don't have the money, and then you spend, about $50,000 a year to warehouse people? I mean, this doesn't make sense.
Well, sure you do. Sure, unless they become geriatrics in prison for long periods of time, and if they're not healthy, it can cost upwards of $100,000 a year to keep one person in custody.
Right.
So I think that this report is right. I make a difference between being tough on crime on the one hand or being smart on crime on the other. And I would simply, for nonviolent offenders, put a burglar or a check offender in jail for a suitable amount of time, then put them out on the streets on a strictly monitored probation system wherein they have to get a job and 20% off the top, goes for restitution to the victim.
Yeah, and
no, that's much less expensive for society. It's good for the offender. They see that, you know, there's a cost at this stuff, and it's good for the victim or the insurance company as well.
Right.
So that's another thing I would change.
Plus, we have, in the best tradition of George Orwell, but nonetheless, we have now the technology to really carefully track these people. I mean, once they get
well,
out.
We do.
And it's certainly
in better shape. Their families don't go on welfare. The father is home or the mother to take care of the children. All kinds of good things start happening once we get over this mindless incarceration thing. Literally, as you know, Tom, we lead the world in the incarceration of our people today.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, here, we're number one does not make me proud.
Yeah, we have more people in prison both on a per capita basis and in terms of absolute numbers than any other nation in the world. We surpassed the Soviet Union a couple of years ago.
That's right.
It's absolutely shameful. Now, the three, and I'm assuming as a judge, you have been forced to sentence people to life in prison or 25 years to life or whatever for what you consider to be a crime that maybe they should serve a year for, or maybe they should be in a community service program for, or something like that?
You know, I am a judge, and I am required by my oath of office to follow the law. And so I do, and I and my brothers and sisters, if we can't distinguish it, if we don't feel that we have an out, in effect, it was within the law, there are documented circumstances in which, in the federal system, we have very conservative judges appointed by Nixon or Reagan that are literally in tears when they see the injustice of what the law requires them to do. And they apologize to the defendant, and they say this is atrocious, and then they sentence him to draconian periods of time in custody. It's just simply not what you would expect a civilized society to do, certainly not what our great country should be involved with.
Yeah, I would think that judges and prosecutors involved in these sorts of things would have, you know, a difficult time living with themselves. I mean, you know, this must be a very, very difficult thing for you.
It is. Why do you think, you know, right this minute, as you know, I'm on an unpaid leave of absence for a year. I'm running for the United States Senate here in California to bring these matters forward. I would, for example, have California treat marijuana like alcohol. We could reduce the overall usage of marijuana that way, because it's easier today for our young people to get marijuana than it is a six-pack of beer.
Right.
As I say, today drug dealers don't ask for ID. We can tax it and bring in revenue and stop wasting all of this tax revenue.
Well, and
so that's just one thing I would do.
Yeah, and marijuana was legal in the United States for more than half of the life of this country. And
indeed.
In fact, it's interesting reading Jefferson's personal notes to himself. It's called his Anas, but it's basically kind of a diary that he kept. He talks about how, I believe it was Tom Paine. It might have been. Might have been somebody else, though, and I don't want to, you know, paint him with the wrong brush. But one of these guys that is, like, you know, well known as one of the real rabble rousers among the founders was very fond of what was then called laudanum, or laudanum. I'm not sure how it's pronounced now, but basically it was opium, and was essentially addicted to this stuff. And Jefferson just talks about how everybody kind of puts up with him, you know, when he kind of nods off, and everybody wishes that he would get off it. But, you know, hey, you know, it's just this one guy, and it was really a rare thing. I mean, there were alcoholics as well. You say that our drug laws have failed, but the response that you know, the other people, that normal society would toss back is, but, you know, what about our children? If we were to decriminalize, you know, these drugs, aren't we endorsing them?
Sure, that's the old "you're sending the wrong message to our children" argument.
Yeah,
and you know something, our kids are human. They recognize hypocrisy when they see it, and they realize, of course, that in many occasions we lie to them with regard to things like marijuana. Then they stop believing us when we tell them the truth about methamphetamines or cocaine or whatever,
right,
and get into trouble that way as well. What you do is you take the profit motive out of these drugs, just like Holland has. And Holland has only half the usage of marijuana per capita in their country as we do here, both for adults and for teenagers. And the Minister of Health of Holland came out with an explanation. He said, you know something? We have succeeded in making pot boring.
Yeah,
that's a big thing.
Yeah, I just have to tell you this. 2-3 years ago, it was right after 9/11. Flights were cheap. I had a bunch of freaking flyer miles. United said, you know, half off on freaking flyer miles. Europe was on sale because nobody was flying. I mean, this was December 2001, and so we took our three kids to Amsterdam for Christmas. And you know, and we stayed in Marriott, you know, a $400 a night hotel for like $90 a night, you know, and we flew for free, and it was incredible.
Yeah.
And we went to this really fancy restaurant right across the street from the Marriott, you know, white linen table restaurant, you know, with you know, the whole bit, next to the casino, right across the street from the Rijksmuseum, you know, where the night watch is and all that stuff, yeah. And the waiter comes by and he hands us the wine menu and the pot menu.
Yeah,
and
sure.
You could, you know, select which pot you wanted, and there's like people around us smoking, and I'm like, whoa, this is new, and yet, I mean, it's that open in that society, it is that open, and yet, as you say, in that society, the adolescent use, well, for that matter, the adult use of marijuana is half of what it is in the United States.
Well, it's true, and whether it was Tom Paine or someone else, Tom, it's a medical issue.
Yeah.
And you can't, the government has no more business controlling what we put into our bodies than it does what we put into our mind in a lot of ways. But if you or I or any of our listeners here end up driving impaired because of, you name it, amphetamines, marijuana, alcohol, that's different. Then that puts our safety at risk.
Sure.
That's a criminal justice issue.
Yeah.
And eventually that's where we'll go.
Yeah, you know, hopefully. I'd like to continue this discussion with you. If you can hang on just a minute, we've got to take a break here. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We're talking with Judge Jim Gray, the author of Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, Superior Court Judge in the state of California, now running for the California State Senate. Is that right?
No, it's United States Senate.
United States Senate.
Barbara Boxer and Bill Jones.
Oh, good luck. Hang on.
It's a big state.
There you go. Hang on, Jim. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Do you want to own a computer? Is your credit less than perfect? If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, then you are already approved for a brand new IBM, Dell, eMachine, or other name brand computer guaranteed. You heard right. Bad credit? No credit? No problem. There is no credit check, so you will not be turned down. If you have a checking account and can afford a weekly payment of $29.95 for just 12 months, you are approved for your brand new name brand computer. Just call 800-588-0596. Freedom Frog Funding says you are approved. So give us a call today at 800-588-0596 to have your brand new computer shipped right to you. And if you act now, we'll add a $200 upgrade and a one-year warranty for free. You heard right. We will upgrade your computer and throw in a warranty absolutely free. So don't wait. Let Freedom Frog Funding send you the computer of your dreams today. Call 800-588-0596. That number is 800-588-0596.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD, and The Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
During the past 3 years, it's true George W. Bush has created more jobs. Unfortunately, they were created in places like China. Bush's policies have encouraged the loss of nearly 3 million jobs. He supported tax breaks to corporations that ship jobs overseas. George W. Bush is taking our country in the wrong direction. It's time to make America work for every American.
While the world's firing book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released, the new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie, Global Warning, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight details what is happening to our planet, the reason for our culture's blind behavior, and how we can fix the problem. There is information. There is hope. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late. Now with new updated information, available in bookstores everywhere.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Judge Jim Gray, a candidate for the United States Senate from California, and a Superior Court judge, author of the book, Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It. Judge Gray, what percentage of your peers, of other men and women on the bench, agree with you that our drug laws have failed and that pot should be essentially a regulated substance like alcohol rather than a criminalized substance?
Well, Tom, that's two questions, either publicly or privately. If it is privately, I'd say maybe 70%.
Really?
Publicly, most of them simply don't talk about it. But a couple have made comments years ago that they didn't agree with me. Most of them, you see, they understand that 80% of all felony crime in Los Angeles County and Orange County, Southern California, is drug-related crime, and it simply inundates our courts. We churn them through the system for no good purpose whatsoever. We don't assist anybody. Putting them in jail for 30 days or 3 years or 30 years doesn't really help, except it removes them from society. But, of course, they can still get drugs when they're in prison, so that doesn't make any difference. So the judges see this. The problem is that most of them just do not want to call attention to themselves, and so they pretty much keep quiet about it.
Yeah,
that's a problem of our war on drugs, because we intimidate the very people that have the information, the expertise, and the credibility away from the discussion. So that's why I wrote my book, and you mentioned the title, and I appreciate it, but it's not only why our drug laws have failed and what we can do about it, a judicial indictment of the war on drugs, because I quote 40 judges from around the country that weigh in with their thoughts as well, trying to get that movement started.
So this is not just 70% of California judges. As one of my peers in the radio industry likes to refer to California, the land of fruit and nuts. This is not just 70% of California judges. What do you think nationwide? What percentage of judges?
I can't leave. I don't have any information about that, Tom. I can only tell you of my court in Orange County, California.
Which is a conservative area.
70% of the judges. It's a very conservative area.
Yeah.
But that's my only source of information, really.
And you would identify yourself largely as a conservative guy. You're running, I assume, on the Libertarian ticket?
Yes, sir. Yes to both questions.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty conservative fellow. I have the revolutionary concept that you should be responsible for what you do.
Yeah, very revolutionary. Okay, 1-866-889-8894. Let's take a quick call here. We've just got a couple minutes left. Roberta in Ojo Caliente is on the line. Hey, Roberta, you're live with Tom Hartman and
yes,
Judge Jim Gray.
Yes, more than a couple of minutes, of course. But greetings from the former badlands of the formerly sovereign Mexico. I want to thank you both, especially this judge, for coming on, as Thoreau said, more than truth, more than fame, more than money, more than love, give me truth. And how can you have justice without truth? I recently viewed a judgment at Nuremberg, and you know the judges were being tried by the American Tribunal in that place after World War II for simply following the laws of the Third Reich. And, you know, you mentioned that is the dichotomy and the dilemma of a judge. That yeah. is what
is there a question? Is there a question there, Roberta? Because we've got about a minute left.
Yes, my question is why cannot, if the judges are in a majority privately on refuting these non-victim crimes of drugs, which should only be punished when there is a crime, why can't they revolt and dissent and change the law?
Good question. What are your thoughts,
Roberta,
about that?
And indeed, thank you for your comments, and I agree. It is our job to follow the law. If you get into the Nuremberg situation, there comes a time where humanity simply has to stand up and say, I don't care what the law is, like slavery or certainly the concentration camps, that sort of thing. But otherwise, you know, it is our responsibility to follow the law. I don't think that this rises to the Nuremberg level, but it's awfully close. So what judges should do, in my opinion, is to speak out, is to let people know what is happening in their names. And more judges are beginning to do that. And talking on Tom's show here, we're spreading the word. It's okay to discuss drug policy.
There you go.
And that's the word that needs to get out there.
Thank you so much, Judge Gray. Thank you very much, author of Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It. I appreciate you being on our program today. Thank you.
Well, Tom, it's a pleasure. In fact, if you could have your folks visit my website, www.judgejimgrayforsenate.com.
You got it.
G-R-A-Y and the number 4.
You got it. Thanks.
27 years, the Progressive Magazine in these times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
IBM already embroiled in a slew of lawsuits over chemical exposure at its computer component manufacturing facilities is now accused of pressuring a scientific journal into spiking a study showing increased rates of cancer among its workforce. The journal, Clinics in Occupational and Environmental Medicine, initially accepted a report which contained statistics showing a higher than normal rate of rare cancers among IBM workers, and especially those at manufacturing plants where various chemical solvents are used in production. Rates for brain cancer and some types of lymphoma, for example, were found to be double the national average for the general U.S. population. The journal, owned by the Dutch publishing conglomerate Reed Elsevier, denies IBM involvement in its decision, but an academic boycott of the publication is already well underway. Yesterday, IBM announced it settled 50 worker lawsuits alleging exposure to toxins at work caused their health problems.
Green Party members aren't apologizing for a Bush presidency and are meeting this week in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for their Forward 2004 convention. They're choosing a presidential nominee, and it may not be Ralph Nader who wins the endorsement this year. Longtime party activist David Cobb served as the general counsel for the Green Party of the United States until declaring his candidacy and was the 2002 Green Party of Texas candidate for attorney general.
The HMOs and the pharmaceutical companies and all the rest of the corporations are making billions of dollars by treating health care as a commodity.
Party members vote for a nominee on Saturday. Also on the convention agenda is a Sunday anti-war pro-jobs march and adopting an official party platform.
The Norwegian oil industry is considering locking out its workforce in order to break a strike at several North Sea oil rigs. The strike began last Friday and stemmed from concerns the workers had about weakened pension proposals and a stalled drive to organize more staff on the offshore platforms. Currently, the strikes cut about 500,000 barrels of output per day. A lockout would effectively shut off the entire spigot, 3 million barrels per day. As Norway is the world's third largest oil exporter and draws nearly a quarter of its national income from oil, a lockout may force the government to step into the controversy.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report.
Bush is the first president since Herbert Hoover to preside over a net loss of U.S. jobs. So why should Iraq be any different? A report released this week by the Education for Peace in Iraq Center urges the Bush administration to put increased resources into job creation. More than 2 million Iraqis are unemployed out of about 8 million. So far, the Coalition Provisional Authority has created about 400,000 jobs, 450,000 short of its stated goal.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live.
Yeah, live and let live. I guess that's one part of Judge Gray's suggestion there. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. It's 27 minutes before the hour. Second hour of our program, and time for the Internet Weekly Report has a fascinating little Laura Bush alert here. So I thought I'd dust off our Laura Bush theme music and let you hear that. This is from BlueCanyonProductions.com.
When I was just a little girl, I knew I'd marry a president.
Yes, indeed, and she did.
I had a song then going through my head, but no idea what it meant. Get Saddam, Saddam, be the king.
Yeah.
To national unity.
Our Laura Bush song. Here's this from Internet Weekly Report. Laura Bush today introduced an updated version of Nancy Reagan's old Just Say No to Drugs campaign. This time, instead of having kids say no to drugs, the First Lady would like all Americans to abandon all reason and just say no to science. As Laura Bush is reported to have said, on this historic occasion here at this flea market in San Jose, we need to put an end once and for all to the age of enlightenment and just say no to science, the ghastly evolution, the teaching of evolution in our schools, and all this ghastly stem cell research devilry. Poor Mrs. Reagan got hoodwinked, says Laura Bush, by her evil Hollywood friends and came out in favor of research to find a cure for Alzheimer's disease because she thought it would help the Gipper. But did it help her or Ronnie? No way, Jose, no pun intended, because my husband, who is such a forward-thinking genius, banned most embryonic stem cell research in this country. Let those pagan French and Germans go to hell if they want to, but we Americans will be on the rapture fast track when the day of reckoning arrives. Let me tell you a little secret the Reverend Falwell told me. Jesus hates science. Well, George and I hate science, too. If God didn't want us to suffer, says Laura Bush, he never would have created uppity servants, Arabs, or trade unions, let alone people with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease. So the next time some satanic science show like Nova comes on TV, just say no and immediately change the channel to the 700 Club or Fox News. Our report for the day from the Internet Weekly Report. Our Laura Bush report. Yes, indeed. Welcome back at 24 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number if you'd like to be on the program. And Chris in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chris, what's up?
That was very good. My son asked me the other day if I really thought George Bush's DNA actually formed a double helix or not. But, well, anyway.
Yeah. What really boggles me, I have this horrible feeling that most of what he said went right over the head of most Americans because the actual discussion has not been honestly played out in the press. The fact of the matter is that if George Bush's logic is followed, then we should ban in vitro fertilization. In vitro is Latin for, you know, in the petri dish, in a plate, right?
Yeah.
Outside the body. And in vitro fertilization, they take the egg from the woman, they take the sperm from the guy, they put them together in the plate because for some reason they won't join inside the woman. They put them in the plate, and they fertilize a whole bunch of... They won't, you know, join inside the woman. They put them in the plate, and they fertilize a whole bunch of ovum, and then they pick, you know, a couple that they think are the most viable, or one that they think is the most viable, and they implant it in the womb, and boom, you've got a baby. And millions, or hundreds of thousands, anyway, of women have this done, or families have this done every year in the United States. And there are hundreds of these fertilized eggs that are left over after every single procedure. And what do we do with them? We throw them in the trash.
Yeah.
And those are the fertilized eggs that everybody is talking about using for stem cell research. And we're not talking about letting them grow into fetuses. We're talking about letting them grow for 2 days so that they go from being two cells to four, up to maybe 256 cells, you know, a maximum of 500 cells. It's not, you know, there's no brain, there's no pain, there's no, it's just a collection of cells. It's a blast, it's called, a collection of cells. And it's going to be thrown away anyway. And so really, if you want to have them every year that are thrown away because, well, they got a couple out of the pile and that's all they need, you know. And Ron was talking about this with Larry, and they both clearly understood it, but neither one of them actually made that explanation. And it's just, you know, people don't get it in America. It's such a shame. Anyhow, that's not what you call it. What's up?
Something I don't understand, and I need your help with it. Okay, the Supreme Court just ruled in Dick Cheney's favor in the Energy Task Force case.
Sort of.
Well, you know, 7-2, yeah, but... They re-referred the case back to a lower court, and the high court pointed out a federal disclosure law that had not been used in that case that might be applied to forced disclosure. What does that
right.
mean? Why did that happen?
Well, that was the sort of. I mean, I'm not an attorney, and I haven't really read a thorough legal parsing of this thing yet because it just, you know, it hit the news an hour before I went on the air.
Yeah.
But the sense that I got is that basically the court said the argument that you guys are using – you guys being Judicial Watch and what was the environmental group? It wasn't Greenpeace. It was
Sierra?
Yeah, the Sierra Club, I think. The logic that you guys are using or the law that you're trying to use, we're not going to accept that. But there may be other laws that could force Dick Cheney to release this, and basically we're going to toss this back down to the lower court, the district court, and you can try and fight it out either on that basis, on that other basis, or on the original basis, and try it again. So it was a victory for Cheney. Yes, it was a huge political victory for Bush and Cheney, because what it means is that this thing certainly will not be litigated again until after the election. But it may not ultimately have been a judicial victory, in my opinion. And again, that's a fast read of it. And I'm not a lawyer. So,
all right. You have a good day.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call, Chris. Good to hear from you. Billy in Santa Cruz is on the line. Hey, Billy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. A couple of things about what you've been talking about and a couple of things I want to throw in. About what you were just saying... about the law, you know, requiring Cheney to fess up.
Right.
Well, the law requiring Cheney to fess up is the fact that America's energy policy is in dangerous trouble. We're all worried about it. It makes us in bed with the Arabs. How about that law? The reality of our situation requires us to trust our government, which we can't.
Right. Well, how about the idea that he's supposed to be a civil servant, that he's supposed to be our employee, that what government does is supposed to be transparent?
Well, now you've got the point. You see, the one thing I've been trying to get across to people for a long time is we used to have a certain... you know, it's like we learn things. Some things we learned 2,500 years ago because of the Bible. Things like respect your mom, respect politicians. Politicians are important, good people. They're not. I really want to turn this around. We need to see the political class as our enemies.
Well,
we actually have to start at that position and only get off of that position with the ones who prove them not to be so.
Yeah, because so many have been co-opted. Well, see, again, we get back, Billy, to the rules have changed. I mean, the cons got into power and they changed the rules. And the rules are such now that corporations can basically own politicians and politicians
exactly.
live in terror of them.
But the thing you read about Laura Bush.
Yeah. Well, it was obviously a satire.
Right, but it was a satire of a factual event.
Yeah.
She did say she was the one who came out because they're such pussies. They sent Laura Bush out to say, doesn't matter what the Reagans want or anybody else, our superstition requires us to make you suffer.
Yeah, that's the bottom line.
So the fact is, Laura, folks, even though that was funny, she actually is standing in your way of getting health.
There you go.
Okay. Now, two other things, real quick.
Okay.
It's amazing how much money the CIA has and how bad a job they're doing. Now, I understand that I'm probably one of the smartest people ever to live, but I still think it was obvious for the last, 20 years that Pakistan was going to be the place from which the bomb was going to get loose. If you didn't know to follow Khan everywhere he went, every phone call he made, I knew it. I always said the Islamic bomb would be the one that gets away.
Yeah.
Well, what a shocker it is. And one more thing while I've got you.
Sure.
You know, it costs $40,000 to go to some colleges.
Yeah.
I figured out why the other day.
Why is that?
It's the only way the Army can recruit. The fact is, when you go to Iraq and you ask those boys, what are you doing here? Well, they love their country, number one. And by the way, loving your country means you should hate your government, but that's another story. They love their country, but you know they're really there to get money for a college education?
Actually, I think it means you should question your government. As Teddy Roosevelt said, questioning the authority of government is one of the highest
until government changes its way of style of being, you should hate your government.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
questioning
we'll
isn't
disagree
enough.
With her, but in any case,
assume the reality, and that is that they're not your friend. This goes back to my original.
Well, it's what George Washington said. You know, government can be it's like fire. It can be a fearsome master, or it can be a useful servant.
Tom, you're younger than me, but when I went to college, I went to Temple University. It cost me $400.
Yeah.
Now it's not 10 times $400. It's 10 times 10, and the reason it is because it's how we force blacks and Hispanics into the Army.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, you've had inflation and, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of universities used to be heavily supported by state funds. I don't know about Temple.
Ten times ten.
Sure.
It's how we force people into an army that people would not enter otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. I don't see it as a grand conspiracy, but that is the cause-effect thing. Yeah. Good point,
and
Bill.
You know what, by the way, while we're on the college thing, it's the one thing I really want, it's the one reparation I would make to black people. I would love it if we would turn around and say, you're right, you didn't really get a fair shake. If you can get into college, we'll pay for it.
Well, I think we should say that to every American child.
Well, so do I, but you see, what we've done now to the colleges is we've made it, though, you want to go to college? Go to the Army, be cannon fodder for a dishonest administration that'll use you to scare people and stay in power.
Yeah, and then you've got to take $100 a month out of your own fund and put it into the fund, and then it only partially pays for college. I mean,
now you're really bumming me out.
Yeah, sorry about that. Anyhow, okay, thanks a lot, Billy.
Thanks, buddy.
Good to hear from you. 15 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. Speaking about government transparency. Just very straightforward here. A watchdog group sued, this from the Associated Press, Attorney General John Ashcroft on Wednesday, that's yesterday, for classifying previously public documents pertaining to a whistleblower's claims of security lapses in the FBI translator program. This again, I mentioned Sybil Edmonds a couple days ago. This is the case. Citing national security, Ashcroft recently classified documents related to the case of Sybil Edmonds, a former linguist at the FBI. The lawsuit charged the reclassifying materials that had previously been in the public domain as illegal and unconstitutional. See, here's what happens. Here's the bottom line. This woman comes out and says, yeah, I worked for John Ashcroft, and we were translating stuff before 9/11, and things were really screwed up in the FBI. And here's how they were screwed up. And she goes through this list. I mean, she's a whistleblower, right? And she testified before Congress in open session. And Senator Patrick Leahy, the Democrat of Vermont, and Senator Charles Grassley, the Republican of Iowa, put pieces of her testimony on their website and on their websites, on their official Senate websites, put letters to the FBI and to Ashcroft saying, here's what this woman told us when she testified before Congress. Would you please explain this? And so what does Ashcroft do? He goes in and he says, okay, that testimony that she gave in open session, anybody could have walked in and sat in the gallery. It was videotaped. The networks got it. Everybody, is now classified as secret. So Pat Leahy had to take the letter off his website. Charles Grassley had to take the letter off his website. There is a group that has been trying to investigate her claims that has had to take it off, that, you know, that really wants to do this. I mean, you know, wants to put forward this information. It's called the Project on Government Oversight. And the executive director, Danielle Bryan, says, "This is an extraordinary and dangerous abuse of power by Ashcroft to improperly use the classification system to hide information that the Justice Department finds embarrassing." They've been investigating her allegations. They want to post their findings on their website because they've been finding that what she said, apparently, has some merit. They'd like to post it on their website, but they'll go to prison if they do, because Ashcroft has said, "No, this is secret now. This is classified. Sorry. You can't talk about it. Even members of the Senate can't talk about it." About my employee talking about what a screw-up I am. "It's now against the law to discuss," says John Ashcroft. This is pretty sad stuff, frankly. Pretty sad stuff. 1.3 million, the magic number. 1.3 million. 1.3 million is the number of winning Powerball tickets that were sold for an October 25th, 2003 drawing. It's also the number of middle-class Americans who in the year 2003 filed for bankruptcy. A larger number than during the Great Depression. More than half of them as the result of medical expenses that were not covered by their insurance, or they didn't have insurance and they were forced into bankruptcy. 1.3 million. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. See, we got to change these things, friends. We got to change it, and we can do it in the ballot box, at the ballot box. Hopefully not an electronic one. It's Tom Hartman, 10 minutes before the hour.
The following phone call was not recorded on February 30th, 2004.
Thank you for calling about DirecTV. My name is Lynn. How can I help you?
Thank you, sir. Thank goodness you're there. You've got to help me. My cable company is raising their rates again. I don't know what I'm going to do.
It's okay, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm glad you called.
They're taking away our favorite channels and charging more. It's just wrong.
Ma'am, I get that all the time. Let me help you right away. Would you like to get over 125 channels of your favorite programming for only $39.99?
Will I still be able to get my local channels?
Absolutely. And because you called American Satellite right now, you can get up to a four-room DirecTV system for free and free professional installation for all new customers with an annual programming commitment.
Oh, thank you. My husband, Nick, is going to be so happy.
Call American Satellite at 1-800-505-1542. That's 800-505-1542. Call now and ask how you can get total choice for only $29.99 a month for the first 6 months. A $60 value. 800-505-1542. Add $4.99 a month for second and each additional receiver. Offer ends July 17, 2004. Call now.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Tom Hartman will be joining the exceptional faculty of The Great Rethinking, The Prophets Oxford, taking place the weekend of September 10th through 12th at Oxford University, England. You are invited to join Tom Hartman in Oxford, along with other leading visionaries, including Vandana Shiva, Helen Caldicott, and Rupert Sheldrake, among others, to rethink and reshape our collective future. The Great Rethinking Oxford premise is that this tumultuous time in our human history may be crafted into the birthing of something truly new. And you can play your part in shaping this new worldview by joining Tom Hartman September 10th through 12th. To find out how, go to the website greatmystery.org. That's greatmystery.org. Together, we will make a difference.
A new study finds that gene-altered crops can contaminate wild plants much faster than previously thought. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Many agricultural crops now contain modified genes. Some have been made resistant to weed killers. Others manufacture their own insecticides. These genetic modifications make crops more durable and productive. But Ralph Haygood, a researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, says some people think designer genes can spread beyond farm fields.
People are worried that if you have a crop growing near a wild plant that is a closely related species, then pollen from the crop, or possibly seeds, could be transferred to the area where the wild plants are growing, and the result could be plants that are hybrids between the crop and the wild species.
If wild plants pick up a gene that makes them resistant to pesticides, Haygood says these hybrids might turn into superweeds. Haygood studied the probability that modified genes could escape into wild plants in spite of efforts to contain them. He found that it's likely to happen sooner than most experts thought.
There's substantial probability of escape well in advance of the average or expected escape time. And that means thinking about the process in terms of the average time isn't good enough. Also, if the crop is widely cultivated so that many wild populations are exposed to pollen or seed flow from it, that further reduces the average escape time and further increases the probability of escape well before the average escape time.
Haygood says his study shows that strategies to keep modified genes on the farm and out of nature need to be improved. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I ain't looking to compete with you. Beat or cheat or mistreat you. Simplify you, pacify you. Deny, defy, or crucify you.
And welcome back. It's 4 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our Bush flip-flop of the day. George Bush opposes McCain-Feingold. As the Washington Post report, George W. Bush opposes McCain-Feingold as an infringement on free expression. But then, of course, on March 27th, 02, as he signed it into law, he said, This McCain-Feingold bill improves the current system of financing for federal campaigns, and therefore I am happy to sign it into law. The George Bush flip-flop of the day. And boy, are there a bunch of them. We'll be doing one a day for it, probably at least until the election. Speaking of Republican presidents, we listened to Eisenhower before. I just wanted to share with you a little clip, almost prescient. Quite remarkable from Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover, who was an opponent, by the way, of the United States involvement in World War I, and that's what he's speaking of. And, of course, this was after the fact. This was as president. And, in fact, this was after he left the office of president. And, in fact, after he left the office of president, Franklin Roosevelt brought Hoover back into the administration. I forget which role he played now, but, in any case, here's Hoover's thoughts on war and propaganda. I thought this was just relevant.
We are ourselves and we are.
Oop, hang on just a second here. I got to push a plug here. The old push the plug routine. There we go. Okay.
We ourselves, when we entered the war, imitated the others. We created great propaganda agencies. And no man dared to question our answer under that fierce organized condemnation.
No man dared to question under that fierce condemnation. Fascinating. And then he goes on to say,
and here we can examine one of the methods of power politics. and that is propaganda. During the World War, propaganda was first developed into an actual weapon no less potent than the killing of men. When peoples and governments weigh the sacrifice of their sons, then truth and honesty and tolerance and justice are thrown to the winds if a lie will serve better.
Truth and honesty and justice and tolerance are thrown to the winds if a lie will serve better. Yeah, there's weapons of mass destruction over there, sure. Yeah, he was good buddies with Osama, sure. I mean, Halliburton did $73 million worth of business with Saddam, but Osama didn't. Anyway, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
IBM already embroiled in a slew of lawsuits over chemical exposure at its computer component manufacturing facilities is now accused of pressuring a scientific journal into spiking a study showing increased rates of cancer among its workforce. The journal, Clinics in Occupational and Environmental Medicine, initially accepted a report which contained statistics showing a higher than normal rate of rare cancers among IBM workers, and especially those at manufacturing plants where various chemical solvents are used in production. Rates for brain cancer and some types of lymphoma, for example, were found to be double the national average for the general U.S. population. The journal, owned by the Dutch publishing conglomerate Reed Elsevier, denies IBM involvement in its decision, but an academic boycott of the publication is already well underway. Yesterday, IBM announced it settled 50 worker lawsuits alleging exposure to toxins at work caused their health problems.
Green Party members aren't apologizing for a Bush presidency and are meeting this week in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for their Forward 2004 convention. They're choosing a presidential nominee, and it may not be Ralph Nader who wins the endorsement this year. Longtime party activist David Cobb served as the general counsel for the Green Party of the United States until declaring his candidacy and was the 2002 Green Party of Texas candidate for attorney general.
The HMOs and the pharmaceutical companies and all the rest of the corporations are making billions of dollars by treating health care as a commodity.
Party members vote for a nominee on Saturday. Also on the convention agenda is a Sunday anti-war pro-jobs march and adopting an official party platform.
The Norwegian oil industry is considering locking out its workforce in order to break a strike at several North Sea oil rigs. The strike began last Friday and stemmed from concerns the workers had about weakened pension proposals and a stalled drive to organize more staff on the offshore platforms. Currently, the strikes cut about 500,000 barrels of output per day. A lockout would effectively shut off the entire spigot, 3 million barrels per day. As Norway is the world's third largest oil exporter and draws nearly a quarter of its national income from oil, a lockout may force the government to step into the controversy.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Bush is the first president since Herbert Hoover to preside over a net loss of U.S. jobs. So why should Iraq be any different? A report released this week by the Education for Peace in Iraq Center urges the Bush administration to put increased resources into job creation. More than 2 million Iraqis are unemployed out of about 8 million. So far, the Coalition Provisional Authority has created about 400,000 jobs, 450,000 short of its stated goal.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where a victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
Hoist a glass of cheer for Percy Schmeiser. Percy's a family farmer who raises grain in Saskatchewan, Canada. But in the last several years, his main crop has been raising hell against the brutish tactics of Monsanto. This multi-billion dollar global pusher of genetically manipulated frankenfoods went after Percy with all of its corporate might, unleashing the hounds of hell from its legal department. Schmeiser raises canola, saving the seeds from one year's crop to plant a new crop the next year, as farmers worldwide have done for ages. But in 1997, Monsanto's hired spies found that some of the corporation's patented, genetically altered canola plants were in Percy's fields, and their seed had been replanted. So this giant sued him, branded him a thief, demanded his profits, and sought damages, penalties, fees, and court costs from the poor guy. Yet, Percy had not planted Monsanto's perverted seeds. Rather, his unadulterated crop had been contaminated by pollen from altered Monsanto plants that had drifted from other fields. He argued that Monsanto's patent was hardly valid in such a case, and that he owed nothing for the seeds he didn't know he had not wanted, and had gained no profit from. He valiantly fought a long and costly legal battle against this bully, and now Canada's Supreme Court has ruled. While a narrow majority said Monsanto's patent was valid, Percy won a big personal victory, for the court agreed that he had not profited, was not a thief, and owed not a penny to the corporation. Also, while the court ruled that Monsanto did have ownership to the altered plants that appeared in Percy's fields, this ruling is likely to bite the corporation on the butt. With ownership comes legal responsibility, and it opens the courthouse doors for farmers to sue Monsanto for contaminating their fields with its adulterated plants. This is Jim Hightower saying, to learn more, go to PercySchmeiser.com.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
I am Gunnery Sergeant R. Lee Ermey, United States Marine Corps. While our armed forces defend our freedom, their families shoulder household duties and emergencies alone. To help, the veterans of foreign wars and Vermont American brand Bits and Blades have created the Unmet Needs Program.
Rufus Forrest here, VFW Senior Administrator. Please support the Unmet Needs Program by purchasing Vermont American Bits and Blades. A portion of each purchase goes to help families.
Visit unmetneeds.com and buy Vermont American brand Bits and Blades. Thank you and Semper Fi. Hoorah!
The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. It's 7 minutes past the top of the hour here. Our news of the day from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. George Bush supports outsourcing prison abuse to India. I mean, you know, why should we do it in Iraq when we can outsource it, right? Calling center in Bangalore to harass detainees.
is the subhead of the article here. President George W. Bush attempted today to explain... He always has to attempt to explain, by the way. Attempted today to explain a newly released White House memo outlining a controversial plan to outsource prison abuse to India. According to the memo, the White House has been actively exploring the possibility of establishing a telephone calling center in Bangalore, India, that would harass Iraqi detainees at all hours of the night with highly annoying telemarketing calls. The memo details a scenario in which telemarketers from India would instruct Iraqi prisoners to remove their clothing and then would badger them with complicated offers involving their long-distance service. The Bangalore callers would also subject Iraqi prisoners to lengthy consumer research surveys about their breakfast, cereal, and television viewing preferences, the memo said. With Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld at his side, President Bush defended the unorthodox interrogation procedures, arguing, quote, "We know that telemarketing is a tool of last resort, but we're at war!" Charles Clyburn, a spokesman for the human rights group Amnesty International, attacked the White House proposal. He said, quote, "This wrong-headed plan involves not only calling prisoners, but also placing them on hold for 45 minutes or longer with Celine Dion music in clear violation of the Geneva Convention," end quote. On the campaign trail in Ohio, presumptive Democratic nominee John Kerry blasted the proposal to send American torture jobs overseas, telling his audience, "With our fragile economy, we can ill afford losing even one prison abuse job to India." Mr. Kerry said there were more effective ways to get prisoners to talk, such as repeatedly playing them his stump speech about health care. Thank you, Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Our number 1-866-889-8894 if you would like to opine on the issues of the day, if you have... thoughts you'd like to share with us. The folks in our chat room, by the way, greetings to everybody in our chat room. Great to see you there. And I've been interacting a little bit, and some of the discussion has been about this this new attempt by the cons. I mean, you know, they've set up this phony grassroots organization, you know, through a PR, through a Republican PR firm in Washington, D.C. MoveAmericaForward.org, it is the organization. And I told you yesterday about how the theater here in town is getting 400 or 500 emails and letters a day from, like, Chicago. You know, people saying, "I'll never set foot in your theater again if you play that Michael Moore movie." Well, now they're trying to say, under the McCain-Feingold Act, the Michael Moore movie is considered a campaign commercial, and it's illegal for third-party groups to run campaign commercials within 90 days prior to the election. And therefore, they're not actually trying to say that he can't run the movie. What they're saying is that he can't run any television or radio advertising for the movie. Because they say... The movie is really not a documentary. It's really not a satire. It's really not something funny. It's really not something that a professional movie maker made to make some money. It's really a campaign commercial. Like, you know, the Democratic National Committee had something to do with this, right? And this is bizarre in the extreme, shall we say. Bizarre in the extreme. It's... just remarkable. Anyhow, interesting discussion about it in our chat room. You can drop into our chat room if you'd like by going to tomhartman.com. You can also link from there to our message board. We just set up three new areas in the message board for topical discussions of things that we discuss here on the radio program, and I do, you know, regularly read it. So you're welcome to drop in there. And 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, your thoughts for the day. Tony in Washington, D.C. is on the line. Hey, Tony, how are you?
How you doing?
Great. Haven't heard from you in a while. Hope life is well.
Can't complain. The line's too long.
There you go.
I got one question to ask you. You said there's a book coming out by a ex-CIA agent in September. I didn't get the name of that book.
Yeah, it's coming out. Actually, I think it's coming out in the next few weeks. It's called Imperial Hubris.
Okay.
And this guy, and here's what's really weird about this, Tony. They reported about this last night on, you know, Aaron Brown on CNN. I mean, I didn't watch any of the network news yesterday, so I have no idea what they did. But I did watch CNN a couple of different times yesterday, and they talked about this book, and they talked about how this guy, who is a senior CIA intelligence officer by the name of Mike. Who has written another book previously. And this book was vetted by the CIA. In other words, George Tenet said, yes, you can publish this book. This book says, basically, that George Bush has made the world, and the United States in particular, far less secure by attacking Iraq, that we're losing the war on terror, that we're doing it all wrong. But the important thing is that in the book, this guy predicts that al-Qaeda will probably strike America just before November 2nd, just before the election, because they want George Bush reelected, because he's the kind of president that helps them in their recruiting efforts. And they're really afraid of John Kerry being elected. And that little fact out of the book, which I thought was the most significant thing in the book, has never, not once, in all of the mentions of this book that I've heard on network television been mentioned. I think that's very strange.
Well, you know, you got to have a car roll situation coming up. So, but my other question is on that, and that is very important. October surprise, what, 101?
Yeah.
They can come up with. But have you ever had a author or anybody from the neocon universe talk about defending outsourcing? And how come we don't hear that? And why won't we hear that as one on the Republican plank this year and, for 2004 convention? And I'll take my hands off the air, and you keep going.
Okay, all righty. Thanks, Tony. You know, I don't know. You know, it's yes, I've had people on defending outsourcing from the either Competitive Enterprise or American Enterprise Institute. I forget which it is, and. You know, their argument is there's the same tired old argument of, well, if we send jobs overseas, it'll make new jobs here. But they never can say what kind of new job. Well, create new opportunities here. Like what? You know, well, flipping burgers, I suppose. Yeah, well, you know, if enough people are unemployed, I mean, who's going to buy the burgers? Well, you know, we'll figure out something. The buggy whip manufacturers went out of business when cars came along. You know, well, this isn't about a change in technology. This is about a change in law. A change in policy, and so anyhow, it's been a while. It's been a few months since I've had any of those guys on. I probably should get one on again because it's a good fight to have, and their arguments are pathetic, and it's always fun to just expose them. 1-866, and thank you for the call, Tony. 1-866-889-8894, our toll free number if you'd like to call in. 15 minutes past the hour, and David in Santa Fe, New Mexico, is on the line. Hey, David, how you doing?
Hey,
what's
Tom.
Up?
How are you?
Great. What's up?
Have you heard anything about something that Bush wants to do in his next term when he says he's going to get in, about testing the mental health of every American and then dispensing drugs if you don't pass the test?
Yeah, I reported on that day before yesterday here on the show when it first hit the wires.
That was the Horowitz report.
No, that was real. That was real. It's a proposal that I'm not so sure that the administration is, like, you know, really pushing for this, but it's something that actually the drug companies, particularly two of the big drug companies, the two that are the largest manufacturers of psychotropic or psychoactive drugs, tranquilizers, antipsychotics, ADHD drugs, these have become multi-billion dollar. I mean, you know, just ADD itself is over, you know, is over $1 billion a year, and that's small compared to depression, and 1 in 10 Americans right now, 1 in 10 Americans right now is daily taking a mind altering drug. I mean, a mind altering prescription drug. You know, when you include alcohol, tobacco, caffeine, and illegal drugs, it's probably, you know, 99.5% of Americans. But in any case, 1 out of 10 Americans is currently taking a prescription drug, and this is making the industry very rich.
I understand all that, but how in the world could he ever make this mandatory?
Well, it's a good question. They're talking about testing kids in schools.
Oh yeah,
get them while they're young.
While they're young.
Yep. Yeah, and that also by testing the kids in schools, they can identify pathologies that may run in families. Right. So you get a kid and, you know, you start testing them and you may say, well, okay, ADD runs in families, depression runs in families, so now let's, you know, let's test the rest of the family. It's really a hustle on the part of the drug companies. It's really, I don't think it has a chance, frankly, although nothing would surprise me with this bunch. And, you know, it might be attached.
I certainly understand it from a money-making viewpoint, but the mind control viewpoint of it is what scares me.
Yeah. Well, I really don't think that's their agenda. I mean, they have a mind control agenda, and that is corporate control of the media, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And the big lie.
It's easier to sedate the masses if you got them on drugs, I guess.
Yeah, well, that was Aldous Huxley's, you know, Brave New World. You know, everybody was taking this drug called Soma, which made them so happy that they really didn't care what the government did. And you know, 1 in 10 Americans taking a psychoactive drug, you could argue that we're already, you know, 10% of the way there or more. You know, and there's a lot of Americans. I consider television a drug, and there's a lot of Americans who are addicted to TV, and therefore aren't, you know, participating in life. A and learning about politics in the real world. B, so you could say we're there. But I really think this is just a money making thing. I don't think it's so much a mind control thing. But I think the mind control aspect of it, the potential for the abuse of it, is what is going to cause even Republicans to be opposed to it ultimately. I hope so too. David, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Our number is 18 minutes past the hour. Bill in Chicago is on the line. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I was you were talking about Lowe's Theater and Fahrenheit and 9/11. I'm going to see it tomorrow at a Lowe's Theater.
Oh, really? That's great. Well, see, they haven't been bought by the Carlyle Group yet. The deal was announced yesterday.
So it'll be quite a while then.
It'll be, you know, well, it might be a few weeks, might be a few months, it might be next year, who knows. I mean, I'm going to see it tomorrow night in our local little art theater, you know, here, the one that got 700 emails yesterday from all over the country. So, you know, but yeah, it's good to know that it's in the Lowe's Theater. Yeah, I mean, the bottom line here is people want to see this thing. You know, there's been all this buzz about it. It's you know, it's just like the Passion of the Christ. I mean, a lot of people were curious about that because Bill O'Reilly was an early investor in it, and he just hyped that thing unrelentingly on his show and in ways that caused other shows to pick up his hype. You know, he manufactured controversy around it. And, you know, Michael Moore was brilliant at manufacturing controversy around Fahrenheit 9/11 run, you know, releasing just before, the week before Con, the whole thing about the, you know, Disney not running it and everything. Good timing. He did a good job. I hope you enjoy it, Bill. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 20 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Tom Hartman here with you. And we shall return directly. Stick around. Got a fascinating Halliburton story for you, in fact.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
It is one of the most powerful books you'll ever read, full of the wisdom of ancient cultures and the directed hope of modern thinkers. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman. Discover how we're made of sunlight and what this has to do with the impact of fossil fuels on civilization. Read about the coming new ice age and what must be done soon. Understand how ancient cultures valued community and cooperation and what we can learn from them. Get in touch with the secret of enough, the meaning of wealth, and the wealth of security. The last hours of ancient sunlight helps us understand and heal our relationship to the world, to each other, and to our natural resources. We have much to learn and even more to remember. Here is your guide, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman, in bookstores everywhere.
For more than 27 years, the progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
When I think about getting older, it's not dying I worry about, it's living and being buried under a pile of medical bills I can't pay for.
Healthcare costs are soaring. Millions more Americans are uninsured, and those who have coverage are paying more out of pocket. Yet President Bush offers no plan to curb costs, and his new Medicare law would actually ban the government from negotiating lower prices from drug companies.
The cost of these drugs, it's very scary.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
But I heard a rumbling calling to my name. 200 million guns are loaded, same cries they came. Better run through the jungle.
And welcome back. Is it time to run to the jungle? I don't. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see what happens on November 2nd. Here we are, 132 days out from the election. Time moving by. Now, a bill in Chicago, I think it was. I don't recall if it was Bill in Chicago or David in Santa Fe who asked about the screening people for mental illness program. In our chat room, Placidus Roy corrects me and says it is called the Teen Screen Program and is already in 168 schools at this point. It's a program put out by Columbia University. So I've asked Roy to post the URL to our chat room there. And if he does that in the next 4 minutes or so, I'll grab it during the break at the bottom of the hour and look up the article and share the information with you. May well be that I'm misinformed about this. Or maybe that we're talking about two different things. Interesting to find out. Family members of a retired New York City firefighter killed in Iraq while working for Halliburton said the Texas company has saddled them with his funeral costs and is mum about details surrounding his death. This is an article in New York Newsday by staff writer Merle English. The guy's name is Walter Zabrisky, and his family's also wondering when they're going to be paid the insurance policy, you know, the death benefit that he was supposed to get. His brother Richard says, we have no information. All we know is he's dead. We have no information when or where or how or why he was killed. just that we have to bury him. Richard Zabriskie has said, quote, according to the benefits, he was supposed to get $50,000. We were told Halliburton would cover the burial expenses. Then we're told that has to come out of the $50,000. This is how Halliburton is treating their people that they send over there to die. Patrice Mingo, a Halliburton spokeswoman, said the family's questions were forwarded to, quote, the appropriate individuals, end quote. She referred further inquiries to the company's website. So, there you have it. Yes. Hey, you know, it's really... Jefferson, in one of his letters to Adams in his later years, wrote about how he envisioned a country where no man would be so desperate that he would be willing to make himself available to be shot at for a shilling. In other words, you know, that people would join the military out of patriotism, but not out of desperation. And, you know, unfortunately, that's not quite the situation we have right now. Not quite. And the same with Halliburton. I mean, you've got, you can make $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year going over there. Which raises a couple of questions. One being, why is it when we can send GIs over there for $30,000, $20,000 a year, whatever, $40,000, that we have to pay $150,000 to Halliburton? Well, the reason, of course, is because we need more people, and it would be very unpopular to have a draft at this moment. I mean, it's apparently in the works if George Bush gets reelected, and maybe even if John Kerry gets in, who knows. The draft boards are being revived. They've been refunded. The people on the draft boards have been asked to track down their associates and get ready for work. And this has been reported widely in the media, actually. It's not a new or shocking or extraordinary or unusual thing. It looks like it's coming, the draft. Because, of course, George Bush, in his brilliance, has massively overextended our military. And even handing tens of billions of dollars to private corporations, we don't, you know, to get their people over there. We don't have enough people. 29 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program.
A must read, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Halliwell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about The Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
IBM already embroiled in a slew of lawsuits over chemical exposure at its computer component manufacturing facilities is now accused of pressuring a scientific journal into spiking a study showing increased rates of cancer among its workforce. The journal, Clinics in Occupational and Environmental Medicine, initially accepted a report which contained statistics showing a higher than normal rate of rare cancers among IBM workers, and especially those at manufacturing plants where various chemical solvents are used in production. Rates for brain cancer and some types of lymphoma, for example, were found to be double the national average for the general U.S. population. The journal, owned by the Dutch publishing conglomerate Reed Elsevier, denies IBM involvement in its decision, but an academic boycott of the publication is already well underway. Yesterday, IBM announced it settled 50 worker lawsuits alleging exposure to toxins at work caused their health problems.
Green Party members aren't apologizing for a Bush presidency and are meeting this week in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for their Forward 2004 convention. They're choosing a presidential nominee, and it may not be Ralph Nader who wins the endorsement this year. Longtime party activist David Cobb served as the general counsel for the Green Party of the United States until declaring his candidacy and was the 2002 Green Party of Texas candidate for attorney general.
The HMOs and the pharmaceutical companies and all the rest of the corporations are making billions of dollars by treating health care as a commodity.
Party members vote for a nominee on Saturday. Also on the convention agenda is a Sunday anti-war pro-jobs march and adopting an official party platform.
The Norwegian oil industry is considering locking out its workforce in order to break a strike at several North Sea oil rigs. The strike began last Friday and stemmed from concerns the workers had about weakened pension proposals and a stalled drive to organize more staff on the offshore platforms. Currently, the strikes cut about 500,000 barrels of output per day. A lockout would effectively shut off the entire spigot, 3 million barrels per day. As Norway is the world's third largest oil exporter and draws nearly a quarter of its national income from oil, a lockout may force the government to step into the controversy.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Bush is the first president since Herbert Hoover to preside over a net loss of U.S. jobs. So why should Iraq be any different? A report released this week by the Education for Peace in Iraq Center urges the Bush administration to put increased resources into job creation. More than 2 million Iraqis are unemployed out of about 8 million. So far, the Coalition Provisional Authority has created about 400,000 jobs, 450,000 short of its stated goal.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
His name was Medgar Evers, and he walked his road alone, like Emmett Till and thousands more whose names we'll never know. They tried to burn his home, and they beat him to the ground, but deep inside they both knew what it took to bring him down. Too many martyrs and too many dead, too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 26 minutes before the hour. The folks in our chat room inform me that it is the teenscreen.org, www.teenscreen.org, the Teen Screen Program, Columbia University's Teen Screen Program. A mental health checkups for youth. The website, this website is a resource for school and mental health professionals and community leaders who want to begin a mental health and suicide risk screen effort in their own community. And for officials who want to learn more about the Columbia University Teen Screen Program, universal screening, and related policy issues. And I'm going to have to go back and find the original news story. I may have tossed it because it was a couple days ago. But I'm informed that this is the program that they're talking about taking it national. And this, according to this thing, it's already in, some 20-some-odd states. And it's a fascinating website. And, you know, it's there you go. The pharmaceutical industry is going to save us from ourselves, or at least save our kids, not to worry. All will be well. Just give them a little Soma, and they'll be happy. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you would like to call in here in the last half hour of our program today, this Thursday, the 20. I got the date wrong yesterday, right? And so I think it's the 24th of June. I had the 23rd written down again. I don't know. Anyway, it's the 24th of June. And 1-866-889-8894. Brian in New Jersey's on the line. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Speaking of depression, I think a lot of people in this country are depressed over money. A lot of my friends are in credit card debt. I'm lucky enough not to have a credit card yet, I'm sure. I was wondering, I know that the founders were adamantly against credit. It was illegal. How did the credit card companies come into effect, and how do they bypass these, I guess, laws or feelings of the founders?
I don't know.
sure.
what I can tell you, you know, in short form, broadly that I know, is that one of the huge debates in, among the founders was whether or not that Alexander Hamilton thought we should have a national bank, and that the federal government should take on the debt that each one of the states had acquired. See, when we fought the Revolutionary War, the individual states borrowed money or went into debt, you know, issued instruments of debt, issued IOUs, basically.
Right.
In order to fight the Revolutionary War, in some cases in order to pay French and German mercenaries, in some cases to pay for war materiel, you know, for whatever. And Alexander Hamilton wanted to consolidate all of that debt and also federally and also create a federal bank. Jefferson thought that that would create too strong a federal government. He was more of a states, you know, keep it decentralized, leave it with the states, let them figure it out. They've got the debt. They can work it out. They know how to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And that battle went on right up through 1846. Hamilton ultimately prevailed, and there was a bank created, although it was created as a private bank. It was called the First National Bank of the United States, and it was incorporated in Pennsylvania, and you know by a bunch of private investors. That bank went up and then went down. That went bankrupt again. I don't remember the year. It was like 1812, 1815, something like that. And then it reincarnated as the Second Bank of America. And that bank went bankrupt in the 1840s. My recollection is that it was in 1846.
Right.
And from that time until whenever the Federal Reserve Bank came into being, which I believe was in... I could be wrong. We passed the income tax in 1913. I think that the Federal Reserve came into being right around that time, but it might have been later. It might have been under Roosevelt, but I don't think so. I think it preceded him.
Because I mean, technically, isn't cash credit, right?
Well, no. Cash is a medium of exchange. Credit is the owing of cash. Now, we had laws on the books in the United States, federal laws, against what's called usury, which said that it is illegal to charge more than 10% interest for anything under any circumstances.
So how do they get away with it?
And, well, what happened was during Nixon's administration, because we had this huge inflation, which was the result largely of Lyndon Johnson thinking that he could have his guns and butter policy, what was referred to as the guns and butter policy, that he could have a war in Vietnam and he could have the Great Society at the same time, basically by running the country into debt. And it's interesting because that was, you know, the position that the Democrats were taking then, and the Republicans were all screaming, we got to have a balanced budget, you know, Nixon being at the lead of them. So anyhow, Nixon becomes president, and he inherits the consequences of the Vietnam War. And we had this inflation where I remember, you know, this was in the early 70s. I think it was 71, 72, right around that time when this happened, although I'd have to go back and look. But, I mean, I'm just doing this from memory. But interest rates were so high that housing interest rates were 13, 14, 15, 16%. Credit card interest rates were 17, 18, 19. They had to repeal the law. They had to repeal the law, and they were concerned that if they didn't raise the interest rates, you know, higher and higher, and the Fed was raising these things, that inflation would get so out of control that we would slide into a situation like Germany did in the 1920s,
right,
where our money would become progressively less worth less and less and less. There are some who argue, of course, that the Fed fueled that inflation by cranking up interest rates, but others, you know, I frankly am not economically savvy enough to have a position on that, you know, on what was going on in the 70s. But that's what happened. They repealed the law against usury. And ever since then, even though the Fed fund rate is now down at 1%, and back then it was like at 12%, which meant that the, you know, prime was at 13 or 14, which meant that, you know, loans were at 17, 18, 20, 22%. Even though now the Fed fund rate is at 1%, and so loans are at 3, 4, 5%, those usury laws were not put back on the books, and so credit card companies are still able legally to get away with charging 20, 25% interest.
22% on most of the credit cards. It's horrible.
Yeah. And there's... You know, the only justification for it, frankly, is that they make money. they're making money hand over fist. I mean, the banking industry is incredibly wealthy, and they're passing a lot of that money out in Washington, D.C., because they want to get their hands on Social Security, you know, on the Social Security Trust Fund, and that will be, boy, will that be a honeypot for those guys. And, of course, that's why you got the cons ranting about that now. But you know, the bottom line is that, frankly, I don't really know the history of that. That would be a question to put to somebody like Paul Krugman, who's an economist.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom.
I'm not. But thanks for the call, Brian. Good to hear from you. 19 minutes before the hour, the death of President Ronald Reagan. I thought this was interesting. Bill Berkowitz emailed this thing to me. It's an article he wrote for Working for Change, Working Assets, workingforchange.com. And it's called Dead Man's Bump. And it's probably appeared in other places. I don't know. Maybe Common Dreams picked it up. But it's about how the Bush administration was hoping, you know, Rove, I shouldn't even say the Bush administration, it's just the Bush campaign, you know, former Enron lobbyist Ed Gillespie, and I forget the name of the guy who's now in charge of the actual campaign itself. Gillespie's in charge of the RNC. These guys were hoping, and Karl Rove, of course, you know, the Mr. Machiavelli, we're hoping that the hoop-de-doop, the five-day hoop-de-doop around Ronald Reagan's death, which I think, you know, there are some who are saying, oh, that was cynically orchestrated, blah-de-blah-de-blah, and I'm sure there was some element of that, but I think that there was a genuine outpouring on the part of the American people. And I think it's that part of the reason why is because it's been 15 years since he was president, and people don't remember the scandals. People don't remember the fact that the Reagan presidency had more people indicted and more people convicted of felonies within the administration than any administration in the history of the United States. You know, so arguably was one of the most corrupt. His support for Iran-Contra, you know, blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah, the whole thing. People, you know, it's human nature to forget the bad times and remember the good times. And I think even beyond that, And I've said this before and been attacked for it, but I'll say it again. While Reagan, I think, was a lousy head of government, that is, his policies were extremely destructive to the United States. He knew how to be a head of state. He knew he was a good performer. The Queen is the head of state of England. Her job is to, you know, cut ribbons and show up and smile a lot and wave at the people and be royal. And Reagan knew how to be royal. In a folksy kind of way, actually. And he was very good at what he did, I mean, in that regard. So in his head of state role, that is the representative of America. Now, around the world, there were a lot of people who looked at him and said, you know, the guy's just a cowboy, and he's a grade B actor, and how can you Americans take him seriously and like that? There was a lot of that going on. And a lot of Americans thought that as well. But he did a decent job, and of that role, head of state role. And so I think that there's a lot of people who maybe even when he was president didn't really like what he was doing, didn't agree with it, thought it was scandalous, who miss him because, by contrast, the guy who's in the White House right now is so obviously corrupt, such a blatant liar. And that's I realize it's a very harsh word, but the evidence is just so clear on so many different things. You know, lying about his service in the National Guard, lying about his cocaine arrest, lying about, I mean, that's old stuff, right? Lying about his service as governor of Texas, you know, what he did, not what he accomplished. Lying about his willingness to fund No Child Left Behind, lying about Medicare, lying obviously about the war in Iraq, and on it goes. And, you know, Reagan probably lied about quite a few things. Who knows? My take on it is that he was going senile pretty quickly. I mean, he was roughly 70, I think, when he was first elected. And I think Alzheimer's already had its fingers into him. And when he was in the Iran-Contra investigation, as a sitting president was asked questions about Iran-Contra, 168 times he said, "I don't remember." Now, if it was Bill Clinton or George W. Bush saying that, I would guess that that was, see, that's the legal argument that keeps you out of jail. Right? If you say no and it turns out to be a lie, you go to jail. If you say yes, then you've then you're admitting a crime. But if you say I don't remember, then you know, that's how you weasel out of things. I don't think that Reagan really remembered. You know, I really think not. But anyhow, the bottom line here, to get back to this point, that this article Bill Berkowitz wrote, was that the Bush guys, the Bush campaign, all expected that by wrapping himself in the mantle of Ronald Reagan, who was beloved at least by Republicans, and perhaps the undecideds, there were a large bunch called the Reagan Democrats, that George Bush would get a bounce. And in fact, he did. His approval ratings went up 6% during the Reagan funeral, from 44 to 50%. But by June 22nd, that's 2 days ago, they were back down again. And now 70% of Americans say the U.S. casualties in Iraq are unacceptable. Only 51% of those polled believe that the war has improved long-term security. That's down 11 points from earlier in the year. And but Berkowitz says, if you thought that the carting of Reagan's body back and forth across the country seemed like a crude and interminable exploitation of Reagan's image by the Bush administration, wait till you see what's coming down the pike. Despite objections by the Reagan family, Bush's surrogates intend to cash in on Reagan's popularity. The Club for Growth, this is the group that ran the ads that largely wiped out Howard Dean in Iowa, headed up by Stephen Moore, right-wing wacko. The Club for Growth, a right-wing pro-Bush group headed by Stephen Moore, is spearheading the drive to graft Reagan's image onto Bush, an anti-Kerry ad originally slated to run less than 2 weeks after Reagan's burial. It was postponed for a week because of protests from the Reagan family. Just a week, right? But beginning this week, this ad campaign is going to be aired on national cable news networks and on television stations in the battleground states of Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin. The ads, quote, portray both Republican presidents as leaders, Reagan on communism and Bush on terrorism, while claiming Kerry was wrong then, wrong now, on national security, according to the Associated Press. The problem is that there's a rift between the Reagans and President Bush. I mean, you know, that they're... There's the obvious argument between them having to do with stem cell research. And you got Michael Reagan, you know, Reagan's son from Jane Wyman, his first marriage, right-wing talk show host, saying that, well, the media continues to report that the Reagan family is in favor of stem cell research. The fact is that two members of the family have been longtime foes of this process of manufacturing human beings. My dad, Ronald Reagan, during his lifetime, and I. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that Ronald Reagan ever came out against in vitro fertilization. I didn't know that, you know, this idea of manufacturing human beings. And I don't believe it. I don't believe it. So anyhow, Michael Reagan says, so Ron Reagan, the youngest son of Ronald Reagan, says, my father never felt the need to wrap himself in anyone else's mantle or pretend to be anybody else. I don't know what's wrong with these people. They have to keep invoking him. It is their administration. It's their war. If they can't stand on their own 2 feet, there are no Ronald Reagans. That's for sure. Yeah. Well said, Ron Reagan. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective for
formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order two bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get two bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive two free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value. Absolutely free. So call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitzky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitzky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
You can cut the energy you use while traveling without decreasing your mobility. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. One third of all the energy used in the world powers transportation. Burning fossil fuels to move around contributes to pollution of the air, soil, and water, as well as global warming. Fortunately, there are things we can do to cut our travel-related energy use, according to Janet Sawin, a researcher for the World Watch Institute. She says one of the most important is the car you buy.
When people are going out shopping for a new vehicle, just try to look for the one that's most efficient. There are a number of hybrid vehicles, even some SUVs coming out on the market within the next year, or just buying smaller vehicles.
Sawin urges you to combine trips in your automobile and carpool if you can. She says public transportation is available in most cities of any size, and walking or biking is often a surprisingly pleasant way to travel. Sawin says government initiatives can also cut energy use in transportation. For example, cities throughout Europe and Japan have invested in commuter rail and bus systems for decades.
A number of major cities have very good public transportation systems, and then there are some cities, such as London, enacted what they call a congestion charge about a year ago, where they charge people for entering into the city of London, and that has encouraged a number of people to leave their cars at home and travel by bus or using the subway. A number of countries also have fairly high taxes on either gasoline or on cars.
The number of cars around the world is rising, as are the size and weight of vehicles and the distances people travel. Sawin says these factors increase energy consumption, making it even more important for people to try to get from here to there as efficiently as possible. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Down in the morning.
that. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tax relief for the middle class. Let's look at some of these programs. In 2003, Congress passed the, this is from themiddleclass.org. In 2003, Congress passed the $330 billion Jobs and Growth Tax Act, designed to spur domestic job growth by putting more money in the hands of middle-class Americans. At least that was the theory, right? And both Kerry and Bush say that's what they're going to do. Kerry's plan provides tax relief to middle-class American families by increasing the child tax credit, reducing the marriage penalty for joint filers, and making permanent the new tax bracket that helps people save $350 on their first level of income. $350. Bush's plan helps working Americans, he says, by focusing tax relief directly at moderate income families and those with children by accelerating the marriage penalty relief, raising the child tax credit from $600 to $1,000, and moving several million working Americans into the lower 10% tax bracket immediately. I wonder if there's an unintended irony there. Yes. He already has moved millions to over 3 million, actually, Americans into lower tax brackets. Well, here's what the experts say. Under the Bush economic plan, the richest 5% of Americans stand to gain more than the entire bottom 90%. If the tax cuts are extended, made permanent. That's pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. The top 5% would make more than the bottom 90%. This when, right now, when you add in payroll taxes, which you won't find, of course, on Rush Limbaugh's website. When you add in payroll taxes to actual income tax rates, you find that the average middle-class American is actually paying the same taxes as a percentage of their income as the average multimillionaire. So the richest 5% of Americans stand to gain more than in the entire 90%. Mind-boggling. Anyhow, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks to Adam Cohen for engineering our program. Thanks to Louise for producing it. Thanks to Brad Walrod for our music. Thanks to our sponsors, particularly Small Dog Electronics. Be sure and patronize them, please. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS for Small Dog. See you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Tom Hartman here.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the project for the new American century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist